to our work. Hope you had a little bit of a respite over the past 2 weeks and you are really re-energized. Welcome Professor Bladkis from the FFC and Sam. I hope you do have a program in front of you which is going to guide us in this orientation workshop for the Standing Committee on Appropriation. Again, as you know, it's an orientation stroke induction still. We're still busy with that process. And let's feel free to ask questions, interact, as I've said even before. We are still all new here, so there is no question that is trivial. The very fact that it comes to you means it must be explained. And if it's that trivial, it should be easy for them to explain. But I always try and say that let's ask anything and everything which troubles us so that we know very well what we're expected to do and our interaction with the Financial and Fiscal Commission. With those few words, we'll allow the FFC to make their presentation and ask honourable members to jot down their questions, their clarifications, and then after the presentation, we'll then interact with the presenters. Prof and Mr. Sent, who are in your hands.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honourable members. From the embassy store and support store. Chair, I'll deal with some of the slides and I'll hand over to Sam to take you through it. I on behalf of the FSC and the commissioners, I really welcome this opportunity because I think it will help us also understand what the challenges this committee will face over the next 5 years. I'm of the view that this is one of the committees similar to the Standing Committee on Public Accounts and the Finance Committee, which is actually the hardest working committees. And as a result, because of the many things that this committee needs to deal with, some of the stuff doesn't filter through in terms of the mandate and the responsibilities of this committee.
Prof, can I just interrupt you? Sorry, Karen. Any apologies?
Good morning, Chairperson, members and guests. One apology from Honorable De Gale. That's it, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Proceed, Prof.
Thank you, Chair. So what I was saying is that my view over the last working in government before, in the administration, and then getting back into the FFC since 2013, my experience of this committee, which is one of the pillars of financial management and accounting within Parliament, is that there's so many things that's going to come via this committee, and it's one of the committee that's actually very much involved in the administration, in the financial administration and accounting of the country. And as a result, because of the many things that this committee faces, some of the stuff has just slipped by, and I think that it's important that we have this engagement with you regularly. If it's not in the slides, if we don't get to say it to you, I would like to inform you that you are welcome to request the FFC to advise you on a number of matters that faces this committee, as long as we get ample time, because part of our response is that we need to give you evidence-based information. It needs to be based on policy and legislation that faces the different appropriations that you're dealing with. So, Chair, we're responding to your two questions that you've given us. The one is about how could legislators improve fiscal oversight, and we're reading legislators including Parliament and provincial legislatures, because I think there's sometimes a classical disjunction in the operation between what's happening in the province and what's happening at national level. especially when it comes to concurrent functions such as health, education, welfare services, and human settlements and others. So we're speaking to you on both accounts, on the account of the Parliament and the account of the legislatures. So part of our job is to look for you at respond to your question about how to improve our fiscal oversight over the executive branch, and we in particular want to suggest to you the associated administrations of the major amendment there. This executive branch is responsible as an independent sphere, responsible for the whole of government, the president is being the custodian of the state. But if you look at the executive branch, we think that it's important to build into that the associated administrations, which popularly referred to as departments. Agencies are effectively those agencies established by national ministers or national departments. Some of it is a regulatory agency, some of it is agencies to deliver particular services for a minimum period. And then obviously the entities. And in entities there, one refers broadly to institutions like the economic institutions such as the Eskom, Transnet, Telkom, the parts of that still belong to the state, Sunrail, and so on and so forth, which all operates within national, provincial, and local government. There's also this the issue that you're asking us to look at Parliament's strength and its intergovernmental oversight and its collaboration. From our perspective, for the legislatures, Parliament in particular plays a central role in facilitating access to and delivery of public service and goods through the following, passing legislation, and within the legislation we'd like to suggest to you there's also the policy process that's going on with Parliament gets involved in before it gets approved. Overseeing government actions and implementation of government's programs by departments and public entities, and facilitating public participation, internal and international participation. The other role of Parliament includes obviously the promotion of the values as in Chapter 2 of our Constitution, which speaks to the Bill of Rights. But more importantly, it's our view that Parliament's responsibility is to ensure upholding of citizens' political rights, basic values, and goods and principles for governing public administration, and also overseeing the implementation of constitutional imperatives. What is critical is there is the question that continuously faces Parliament is the issue of the issue of rights versus the issue of interests. And we continue to seeing that finding its way in various conversations that parliamentary committees are involved in. On the oversight role of the legislature, the oversight role is constitutional mandated function of legislative organs of the state to scrutinize and oversee executive action in any organ of state, and that is particularly in terms of Section 4, 22, 3, and 55, B2 of the Constitution. It also entails informal and formal, strategic and structured scrutiny in respect of implementation of the laws, policies and the various conventions that is part of the broader regulatory and mandatory responsibilities of entities, departments, and a range of institutions. The application and implementation of the budget and appropriation and compliance with statutes and the Constitution. Parliament and legislatures must oversight to achieve country outcomes, and in particular it's important there because there is if one dumbs down on it, then it's essentially to look at the outcomes. Outcomes 1, 2, 3, 4 as government has put together, but much more critically is the priorities. The view of the FSC is that whenever Parliament in parliamentary committees and especially this committee engages with the members of the executive branch or their agencies or administrations or the various entities, is to look at what are the priorities, what were the priorities that were set in the State of the Nation in particular, but also in the different manifestos. And the issue is that to achieve the country outcomes is a longitudinal thing. Because one needs to look at how does the outputs relate to the outcomes to be achieved. Because outcomes gets measured over 5 to 10 to 15 year period, because it's an evaluative thing. You can't see outcomes immediately. So one does a need to look at what does it mean in terms of the inputs to be achieved. A key thing that if I may just stand still on the outcomes question, a key thing that we've learned over the years through various works is that it's easy to look at the issue of inputs. And there's a whole continuous debate around what is the nature and extent of inputs. And their departments and entities talks about inputs in terms of staffing inputs, the number of staff and human resources required. They talk about financial, meaning what is the budget talking about, and a range of other inputs that needs to be to put into the system. So what very often happens in the parliamentary process over the last 20 years, there's always a measure about whether those inputs have been delivered correctly, fairly, and whether we can see with the eye, whether we can see whether we can see exactly what is the administration doing. What we don't measure adequately, consistently is outputs. What are the outputs that are supposed to be delivered? Let me give you a classic example. Many years ago, there was a bridge built in a road in one municipality, and the road was supposed to be one province supposed to be under the 20-kilometer road. By the end of the 5 years, they said they built the road, and we asked them, "So, how long is the road?" They said the road is 70 kilometers, and the issue is there's no road. The input and the agreement was that you're going to build the road for 120 kilometers. Because what can you do with 70 kilometers? If the 70 kilometers doesn't have a spillover effect in terms of economic, a spillover effect in terms of schooling, a spillover effect in terms of just the movement of people and goods and services. And that road is not even close to the main road, which is the freeways and the other provincial roads or a municipal road. So there's actually no road, because you were supposed to build 120 kilometers. In another instance, there's the whole thing about you're supposed to build a bridge. Now, this happened in a province called Mpumalanga some years ago. And the bridge was just built. And you ask, but where do you build bridges? You build a bridge over a hazardous place. You build a bridge over a river. You build a bridge between mountains, and so on and so forth. And the question is, was that a bridge or was it just another road? So there's the input issues. And I'm saying many years ago because it is more than 10-15 years ago, you know. So the issue is about what are the inputs that what are the outputs that needs to be delivered. And here's the other thing that we never look at is the throughput. What is the throughput that needs to be delivered to be able to make sure that we actually achieve what we wanted to achieve? And part of the throughput is going to do with what's the end goal? What's the end goal that you want to achieve? And what are the things that impact on the throughput? For example, if you take an education, we want all our children to have a good understanding of language, because there are two issues in schooling that we also sometimes not talk about. The issue is language, and the issue is the ability to account, to subtract and plus and that, to understand that. If a child is able to do those two things, then the others are just consequential issues that happens. So when a child reads matric and the child can speak and write his mother tongue language, one or other two languages, but the child understand mathematics, all the other subjects can be dealt with. So that's a throughput issue. So for example, history, if you can read and write, you can do history. If you understand the numbers issues, you will remember the dates when certain ugly things happened in South Africa. You know, 1920, okay, it's a number you will remember, but it's also
But professor, remembering dates are really numbers things. I'm saying it in a jest.
Okay.
That our grandmothers who never did mathematics can remember those days, like.
Yes.
Continue.
Yeah, you're right. But the thing is that you said there's a linear effect of numbers. The linear effect is I don't want to ask you that, but the issue of the linear effect is that that numbers run from 0 to 9. Right? And anything after that is about 0 to 9. It's not different. So if you go into the tens, if you go into the hundreds, if you go into the millions, it's 0 to 9, 0 to 9, 0 to 9. Now, so we don't get learned those, the linear effect of numbers. And that's the throughput issues that one needs to look at in terms of the investment of the country. So the point I'm making is that while we're saying achieving the country's outcomes, I think sometimes we're using outcomes as wrongly, because it's about input, firstly, it's about output, and it's about throughput. Outcomes comes 10, 15 years down the line when you've measured what was the effect of that policy or intervention that you've made on the community. So sometimes we ask the wrong question, and we also get the wrong answer. Because no department can give you the outcomes if their policy was implemented 3 years ago. Can't. It's impossible. But if you ask us, what has been the effect of our constitution and the 1994 governments, the fixes of governments on education, then you could say that we have better outcomes, educational outcomes, or better health outcomes. In fact, on the health sector, we've had better health outcomes. The HIV-AIDS issue has been tipping down in terms of that. So that's the outcomes issue. The other issue is that we have a view that Parliament and legislative oversight are always timely or well synchronized with government planning and the budget cycle. The suggestion is that out of the subtext of that statement is that there's probably a need to ensure that. I remember, Honorable Chair, when you were part of the Finance Committee with Eunice Karim at the time, you and Eunice Karim argued. Sorry, this is a workshop, right? You and Eunice correctly argued that the program of Parliament cannot be an executive-driven program. Right? Now, I don't know what it meant. I still know or don't know what it meant. I mean, I've got my own interpretation to it. But I think what needs to happen is that requires a debate as to who drives Parliament's committees. And when these things get tabled, what is the timing framework for it? What are the particular outputs that need to be required to be delivered to be able to deal with certain things? Okay? Because the system and then just oppose that with a statement that was made by late Collins Shabani when he said that that members of Parliament mustn't forget that he's also a member of parliament, even though he's also a member of the executive. Okay? So that's quite a tricky thing in our proportional representative system, that it requires some thought through this to know how do you exercise your role in terms of oversight and accountability. Because both of those are right. Both of those are right. But what does it mean for a committee like this, and also how does it then, how the committee then to look at? Which functions will it prioritize? And why will it prioritize those functions? For example, one would think that finance and economics, economics and financing, given where we are, given the growth levels, given the ability to make sure that the economy is working and very fast so that we get out of this dark space that we are in, so that we can be able to make sure there's employment, that one would prioritize the financing and economics departments. But if you do that, do you do that at the expense of the bigger departments? Because you're going to have to face up going forward in this year the big change in health, which is the National Health Insurance Scheme. How does it pull? And how does that then connect with the appropriation bills in it? So the point is then, how do you then as a committee look at what's happening in the broader planning of government relative to your own planning and relative to how the budget cycle works? Because the issue of the success of South Africa, but also the issue of a problem that we're facing, and it's the issue of stability, our budget cycle don't change. There's one thing in South Africa that's stable. It's the budget cycle. I mean, you can have stability in the political system, in parliament, throwing each other with bottles of water, in legislatures, in elections, etc., etc. But there's one thing that remains stable, it's the budget cycle. For example, there's the budget day in February, and if you go on to end of October, you get the what many prefer to the mini budget, which is the E&E mini budget policy statement, etc. So those things remain constant. And our view would be that this committee in particular needs to be on top of that and see exactly how it actually can manage that cycle relative to the planning, but also to its own problems, and give their own triggers as to what it prefers to see, so that it doesn't become an executive branch-driven committee program, but rather what you consider as the priorities of it. We have the view that there's also part of the accountability value chain which that's not well aligned. Parliament, presidency, ministers, provincial legislatures, premiers, MSCs, mayors, local councils. A surprising thing that I got to hear in a place in Johannesburg 2 weeks ago or last week ago, is that President Mandela and President Thabo Mbeki used to attend committee meetings. They cherry pick their own committee meetings. For instance, if you say you're going to look at Congress chair members, today you want to see the Department of Health and the National Health Insurance Scheme, then one of them, depending who was the president, and they feel that that's an important matter, they will sit in that committee meeting. And sometimes they catch out by attending meetings that the minister that's supposed to be there is not present. You know? Or the minister would say certain things, then they would say, but this is not what this report is saying. I've been in one where, I won't mention the minister's name, where President Thabo like said, but the report is not saying what you're saying. The parliament's report and your own report at your table is not saying what you're saying. So they use sometimes the meeting as a way of monitoring observations and that. So that would be a great thing if it can happen. I don't know. There's a whole thing about the performance agreements that get signed with the president. The performance agreement comes from President Zuma's era. And it's based on the whole...
Just a second.
Prof, I want to agree with you about the importance of presidents in particular attending certain sessions. Sorry to cut you short. I think another example is that former President Zuma used to attend ordinary sessions. And what he would do, whatever he would say during debates, even though he would not participate in them. But when he got an opportunity to address the House, it also referred to some of the things that MP said in ordinary sittings and debates. He did that several times, from the period 2009 to 2014. Didn't do much of it from 2014, for obvious reasons, up until 2019. But it was also a very good thing.
Thank you, sir.
Let's note that. Thanks. Good.
In fact, it's probably conceivable that you can raise in your own caucuses. I don't know where your caucuses are. Whichever caucuses you attend, that maybe the president must attend these things. But here's the importance of that. It condones the separation of powers, but it also creates a soft, what we call, in budget we call it soft budget and hard budget, but it creates a soft form of accountability where the president sits in and listens to some of the things. The premier signs a performance agreement. The whole thing is that the performance agreement based on the outcome-based priorities, all of Malaysian, it's a Malaysian thing. Some of us went to Malaysia to go learn the Malaysian model. We spent 3 weeks there, what they're doing, it. They call it the whole project is called Big Fast Results. And a classic example is that there were criminal thefts like we have in the Cape Flats and in some of the areas, and there wasn't criminal activity. There wasn't enough police on the roads in that. There wasn't enough police. So they went through a deep process of a whole country, civil society, communities, government officials, politicians, the president, and that. It's almost like a festival of ideas, of planning for 6 months. And they went through every single budget. That was the intention that President Zuma introduced. It didn't come to that point, but let me explain to you what happened then in Malaysia. Struggling to find police, they managed to find, through their assistance and checking, they found the police, 100,000 police. They had nothing, eh? Not police. Because remember, it was the motorbikes and the pickpocketing and the motorbikes where the guys drive motorbikes and grab the bags, especially from females, especially in tourism areas. They found 100,000 police. Where did they find them? In the bushes. Those 100,000 police were in the bushes and they were there since the war. And everybody forgot about them. So through that process, then they identified out, that's how the crimes just went down in Malaysia. Because they brought them back into the civil society, changed their role as part of military, and they in dealing with that. So there's a need, that process shows how do you then reprioritize. It's all a question of reprioritization. And if a department says to you that we don't have enough money, we will come into and tell you that. It's every year, it's been there since the time I worked in the National Tourism, my 10 years and beyond my 10 years. They will come and tell you there's no money. There is money. The question is, where's the fat? Where's the fat in their budget? They won't tell you where the fat is. Hence, I'm saying to you that it's important that you need to check what are the inputs, what are the outputs that are required, but also check where they prioritize and how they prioritize. On that. So these agreements, this then needs to be checked. So it's not going to help only looking at the department's vote. I would advise this committee to also to get the performance agreement signed between the president, if it's signed. because we know some of these agreements, in our days we talk, say the cluster approach to things doesn't always help, because the cluster approach helps to protect departments from each other, you know. It's like this thing, we're all together into, we've got a fragile alliance in the cluster. If you question too hard my minister, I will come back and question your minister, you know, or your policies or your questions and that, so, that you have. But it's also this thing that there seems to be a need to chairperson to relook at this, if you can, and see how it works. There's the whole thing about the accounting officer, which is the DG, and what the DG is responsible for. The reason I'm raising this is because I'm sitting with the same problem as the chair of the FSC. There's the accounting officer and there's the executive authority. Now, the reason I'm raising that, the accounting officer, which is the DG or the CEO of a company, a public company of government or a department, are the accounting officer in terms of the PFMA, which basically means they're responsible for the administration and the running and implementation of services. That's the one part of it. The executive authority is responsible for policy, because the policy comes from the politician. And the minister or the deputy minister introduces policies inside government, inside parliament, that will eventually become legislation. What we're not seeing in that process, and this is with hindsight over years with hindsight, is that the practice is like the director general or a delegate of the director general will introduce legislation to you, where the legislation is actually the legislation of the party, of the political party, the majority party. And those officials are not. The executive authority or the custodian of those policies and legislation which they introduce to parliament. Now you're going to have the same with the appropriation. You're going to have the same with different policies and that. And I know I'm going to be in trouble for this with others. I mean, but I'm always in trouble in any case. Is that the policy is the responsibility of the minister, not of the director general. If this was a particular forum, I would have said to you something else about the policy.
Prof, why do you think there can be anyone who's in trouble about that, because that's how it is?
Well, the trouble point is this, is that I'm not so sure sometimes, Chair, whether the policy originates out of the party, from the party, inside the party, to be tabled, because sometimes the policy is in contravention with the policy imperatives, with the values and the principles of the majority party that's tabling it. And it might be the issue of talking, you're talking with two sides of your mouth, but that's the story that's there, because when question gets asked about policies, I mean, if we're not there, we see it on TV, that officials can't answer the origins of the policies. They can't even help to solidify the values of the policies. And they struggle to connect the policies to the majority party's election manifesto. But even when the opposition members in the committees and in parliament ask their questions, it's like they're falling apart, because the reality is that the policy as tabled is not the policies understood to be introduced. And that's a serious problem. It's an old issue around the political economy of policies and legislations and bills. That's why sometimes when you ask, okay, when this thing comes to you, what is the implementation plan? And what's the pricing and costing of a policy? They can't tell you that. Because if you follow the value chain of policy, you start with policy design, policy drafting, and then it goes through to policy implementation. And before you get to policy implementation, you need to know what's the cost of that policy. You also need to know what's the total pricing of it, so that then you know what the conditions to it. That's why when you're going to deal with, in particular, the National Health Insurance Board or any other board that's coming to you, it's nice and it's a good thing to implement this, to approve these policies, but you need to know what's the risks. And I'm not talking here about risk to the private sector or risk to private individuals or risk to GPs on the street that's overpricing people. I'm not talking to that. I'm talking what's the risk to the overall fiscus and how do you mitigate the intervention. But also how do you systematically look at the potentials of a phased approach to do these things. That's why you need to know what's the costing and pricing of legislation. You're going to get, for instance, the appropriation on ESCOM. A key question would be, a number of guarantees has been given over these years, and it's totally to close to 400 billion rands, if not more. You can't just deal with the appropriations as it stands in front of you. You have to reflect on previous government guarantees going to the same organization. And there needs to be a report as to what has happened with the previous guarantees, how did you deal with your liabilities in those guarantees, how did you deal with the repayment schedule of those guarantees, what is the debt management question that sits within those guarantees, and where are the risks within it. And because ESCOM, if the government guarantee to ESCOM is linked to our sovereign, if ESCOM collapses, the IMF will say, yes, now we're going to South Africa. And we know that we don't want the IMF, the International Monetary Fund in South Africa, taking control. We don't want austerity measures the way they're doing it. We don't want structural adjustments the way they're doing it. So there are sets of questions that need to be asked. You might not be politically popular, but what's the use of popularity if you can't manage the risk to society in the future? So there are questions that need to be asked that brings in, because you're the sovereign, you need to protect the sovereign. So there are sets of questions that needs to be answered before you say, we agree with this. I know you will not disagree with it, because you can't disagree with it, because otherwise you're in serious trouble, but you need to be satisfied that the standard of measures has been properly dealt with within the number of government guarantees. In fact, the biggest question that we have for the National Treasury, which we haven't done it formally, but a thing that we're advising you on, because part of our job is to advise Parliament, is a simple question. How does Treasury approve a government guarantee? Is there a government guarantee framework? If so, what does it say? Otherwise, it means that if we don't have a framework, then we make billion-dollar decisions based on our subjective views about a particular matter. And I'm not suggesting it's subjective. I'm just saying that it needs to be checked, because there's economic questions to be asked. There's fiscal questions to be asked. There's service delivery questions to be asked. There's management questions to be asked. There's debt questions, repaying of the debt questions that needs to be asked. And these things have got implications for the fiscus.
Just a second.
If I may, I just want to backtrack a little bit to the point made earlier where you also then jumped in, which is around where policy is actually coming from. And I think we must be honest with ourselves as a, in the workshop environment. So I'm not saying my party hat is not on chair. Let me be clear. So Chatham House rules. After this, you didn't hear me say it. But parliamentary monitoring group is yet to write it down. So I guess I won't reject it. But there's a situation that's emerged, and it doesn't matter where you look. Where people win elections, it doesn't matter which party you look at, across the board. Take executive office. And then officials begin to run circles around the people who have just won an election, whether regardless of the party. And the officials will, you'll go, you'll say, I have my manifesto, I need to implement my manifesto. If you win an election, that's what you do. But then you have officials who come to you and say, sorry, we can't do this, and they'll produce a legal opinion telling you why. And that legal opinion is completely distorted. But they will find every reason in the book not to implement your manifesto, whatever your manifesto might say. And eventually you end up with a situation where instead of having politicians who tell officials, this is what our manifesto is, this is what we were elected on, this is what you will do, our politicians end up defending officials to the public. And that's become a major distortion in our democracy. And I watch it particularly at local government level with previous administrations and current administrations, and across party lines, where these officials then begin to, particularly the local government, use the politicians as a defense mechanism for their poor performance. And as a result, when the point was made earlier that policy has almost been taken away from the politicians, it's because we might have a good rules-based order, but that rules-based order is being manipulated by people who don't want to perform. And I think we need to be honest about that. So I appreciate that comment very much because it's certainly my experience as well. Thank you.
Honorable Sarupet, again, that's a valid point to raise, even in front of whoever, because it's something that should be addressed. And I think we need to be open about this thing. So for me, it's a valid point. I think one of the problems, for instance, if I'm an executive, why should I depend on my DG about the legal opinion of what I want? Because as you know, that sometimes what comes out of the legal opinion depends on how you briefed the attorney consent or the senior consent. I'm just saying, again, I think there is something that the executives can do about that so that they don't find themselves having to defend things that they don't understand themselves, with due respect. So, thank you. Honourable Zambo.
Thanks, Chair. Perhaps, Chair, before I come into this one, I think as a process issue, if you as the Chair can, as Ubrov presents, have a pause and you allow us for a bite, because the whole presentation is actually interesting. Chair, you know, I have noted, you know, Slide number two, it's exactly what is now raised by the honourable member down there, where Prof was emphatic on the actual role. I'm putting my own words now, Prof. You didn't say the actual role, the actual role, but you were emphatic on the role that we, as this particular committee, should play in terms of oversight. And you were comparing and contrasting the manner in which other committees have been and are operating vis-à-vis the importance of this particular one.
And I think, Chair, what becomes important for this particular committee is for the members of this committee to, across political divide, oversight government on what that particular government promised to the people of South Africa. Because as seated here now, we can pride ourselves that the ruling party is here, voted by the majority of South Africans and all that. Now, if now, for whatever reason, the very government chair, let me use another word which was not raised here, with due respect, misled, is misled by whoever, using whatever advice that has been solicited for from wherever. It is the responsibility of us, as this particular committee, to say yes if you have to say yes, and say no if you have to say no. Wearing the face of the Committee on Appropriations, regardless of who we are in terms of the political divide. I think that is one part, you know.
Chair, just to share with you, I just popped in into a particular standing committee of a municipal council, deliberately. And we're like, an MP. And I said, no, continue. I'm here as an ordinary member of South Africa. I'm here as a South African citizen. And then I said, I wanted to teach that municipality a lesson that they must know that all meetings are open. It goes now to what Prof was saying, that not necessarily the presidency or whoever, even ourselves, we are free to get into whatever committee and just sit there as appropriations, though you will not be carrying that care. But you take notes so that when you come back to us here, you are able to brief us that, look, there is a challenge in that particular department. I just wanted to raise those things.
Thanks. I definitely want it to be interactive. Perhaps
let's take it 2 minutes. Let's give for 30 minutes to present and you stop there and then allow the honorable members to interact so that it really becomes an interactive. But just to summarize what we've just said right now, I think there is one thing that we should all agree that there is no disagreement on. That irrespective of the political party we are coming from, who are all interested in service delivery. So anything which purports to be service delivering and it end up doing something else is a concern, is a collective responsibility and a concern for all of us. So I think that point, even the executives, right, we don't want to find ourselves in a situation where the executive is a buffer between ourselves and the officials. Again, I think if that happens, we should be able to cut through the veil and deal with the issues. I'm just looking here at, for instance, the irregular, wasteful fraud and corruption. You know, people who end up answering on this thing with the benefit of one having been more or less in a virtual space of time in all these places, people who come and try to answer on irregular, wasteful fraud and corruption are the politicians who come in. But I'll tell you, having been part of the executives don't even approve a 1 cent procurement. Mm-hmm. You don't do that, but you must end up being accountable for that. I think there's some disjuncture there, because when Honorable Kwamba sees me there, he goes for the jungle.
Yeah.
And doesn't know that I don't even approve a pen that I use. And I think there's something that, again, I'm just throwing that one in and say, how do you deal with some of those things? Because if I know as an executive authority has got a political oversight responsibility over your department and so on and so forth, but as to exactly how you exercise that, because in some instances there is a Zondo Commission, you may hear people saying, and the minister came in and sat in a procurement committee meeting. And that's the red flag, a big red flag again, and which can be raised at any time. So that all these mm-hmm. things which I think we need to deal with and see how we understand. It is a process. We may not be able to solve all of that, but I think it's very important that as members of parliament, we also understand that so that we see how we interact. But having said that, again, the politicians should be able to be frank with us to say, this is happening and that's what I tried to do and I couldn't do it and so on. They shouldn't come and be seen to be a buffer where we're not able to ask these questions that we're supposed to ask. Because if we don't ask them, we end up compromising what you said. We're all interested in the service delivery that we're speaking about. If people have said they want roads in my village and so on, it's irrespective of which political party I come from. If there's no water in my village, my municipality is an IFP municipality. But if there's no water, it doesn't matter whether I'm IFP or ANC or UDM and so on. There is no water. It's a fact of the matter. If I may share with you, at one stage in my village, it was Christmas, and I come there, there is no water. And I ask people, say, no, we have not had water for the past 3 months. 3 months is no water. What's the problem? We don't know. Nobody talks to us. So on the Christmas day, it was even before I joined Parliament, I found tried to find a mayor, so I couldn't get him or her so that I can just protect the identity. I couldn't. Then I phoned the radio station. I said, I hear you guys are talking about Christmas. We don't have water, let alone the other things that you are talking about. And the radio station started saying, Mayor so-and-so, we're looking for you. And she responded. And they said, in such and such an area, we're told there is no water. And I said, no, you can give the mayor my number. And the mayor got my number. Guess what? Within 24 hours, there was water in that area. And there'd been no water for about 3 months. And it turned out that there was a valve which was missing. And the official just came, took a license type of attitude to that. So I'm just saying, why I'm making this example, honorable members, to say, the question of service delivery has got no political party colors. We're all concerned about the same thing, and it's our collective responsibility to make sure that those who are given a responsibility to deliver and you approve budget here, they should be efficiently approve that budget. Thank you, Prof. Sorry to interact, but I think the honorable members who started this, they just reminded me, and it's a very emotive issue. Mm-hmm. Very emotive issue to all of us. So we shouldn't be seen at any stage to be trying to defend the indefensible. Yeah. If people don't do their work, we should say they're not doing their work so that there can be corrective measures.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I actually don't mind stopping and listening to what members are saying, because I think it also helps clear in my own head and for my colleagues to understand also on how the committee responds to certain things. So we don't have to do it at the end, but your permission. So your example that you gave about the minister not spending a cent or whatever, the politicians, when I hear some of them asking questions in Parliament in January, because we get a chance to come over, especially when we listen and that. We also share which ones we want to see on TV, which ones we want to sit and listen. Some of us are lucky we sit in the speaker's box, you know. Because of our constitutional structure. There are a couple of Chinese walls. There's the big Chinese wall in terms of separation of powers between Parliament, the executive, and the judiciary. Everybody seems to understand that. But if you take it down, there's a Chinese wall between the accounting officer and the executive authority. And it's a principle I was trying to explain earlier. So the executive authority will be the minister who's got an office probably between 7 to 10 people, sometimes it's 15 people, depending on that. And the minister will have two advisors. Three ministers and special advisors. The minister and the special advisor never get into the administration. Never. Never. So they never get to say you must give MP X 20,000 Rand and MP Y 50 million Rand. They never get into that. They get into the policy questions. It is the policy questions of what is department is to achieve. And hence, it is so critical that when you deal with the the annual financial statements and the annual report, the person that must take substantive and the substantive and material responsibility and accountability for that is the CEO or the Director General, not the minister. The minister needs to be there, yes, to be able to respond on the policy questions, but also to respond on when the department has not done what it was supposed to achieve in terms of the policy stuff. Because you give the policy, and policy drags, policy legislation drags the funding. That's the minister's responsibility. And the minister must be able to say, why is this not happening? But in terms of spending every single thing, ministers don't do that. In terms of where staff must go, who's employed, in which area, ministers don't do that. Ministers appoint, in my experience, the system might have changed. Ministers are involved in an appointment from a director to a deputy director to a chief director. Right?
Did you get involved because you were part of the,
yes,
we are part of the interviewing panel, although ultimately the president was going to be the DG. You get involved with the DDG, you get involved in the chief director. I think below that
right. So the point I was trying to make is that there's a point where the minister stops involvement at the chief director level in terms of appointment. Anything above that goes to cabinet. Deputy director generals, director generals, even though the minister is part of the interview process with other ministers, and that goes to cabinet. So cabinet make a decision on it. So the point is when the administration goes wrong, sometimes the ministers are find themselves in the catch-22 situation, because on the one hand the executive response, they're the executive authority over the function, and the other hand is an accounting officer. So it's quite important to be able to manage that. In our work, there are essentially three constitutions, which I think is also related to this committee. The one constitution is our own constitution of 1996. The other constitution is the Foreign Finance Management Act. And the third one will be the Municipal Finance Management Act. Now, all the other things sit in that space, provision of revenue, appropriations, and so on and so forth. So I think the point I want to make is that it's sometimes useful to look at the three constitutions that this committee faces. And I would venture to say the three constitutions is South Africa's constitution, and then a subsidiary part of that constitution is BFMA, which is the constitution, financial constitution, if you like. It brings all the other parts of it, the provision of revenue, appropriation bills, agency agreements, and so on and so forth, sits in there. And votes sits in that constitution. And then the other one is the Municipal Management, Municipal Finance Management Act, which is quite critical. That's the reason, say, why I say that your work is much more dense. There are more work here than if you've agreed to serve in this committee and you didn't know, then the committee that the other committees don't sit with the same problems as you, sit with the same challenges as you. It's a lot of work, it's a lot of reading, it's a lot of reviews that needs to be done. And whatever passes you becomes the financial legislation of a particular functional area. And that's quite a huge responsibility that this committee has. The issue around the failures in the government system of performance management, sometimes you get to a situation that the performance of a there's always the kicking the can down the aisle in terms of down the road is who's actually responsible for the management of a department or entity. And in many instances, that needs to be put. There are two levels. One is the policy performance and legislative performance and new legislation. The other is the institutional performance, the administration. And I think one of the key things that I would also want to leave with you that, if you like, is the when we talk about institutions, we talk about three things. We talk about the rules of the game as part of defining an institution, which is basically the rule of law. There's the issue of leadership, which is people, which has got to do with leadership at the administrative and executive level. And the third about that is about systems and the processes related to it. So one is look at it. There is the issue about conflict of interest and the sort of effectiveness of oversight. I think sometimes we find the administration coming to complain to you and not taking this accountability for it. What has been quite an interesting development over the last months when the court, the Constitutional Court, decided that the public protector must take personal responsibility for decisions and also the court action. Now, that is the reason why I'm saying it's quite critical. Who takes responsibility for success of mismanagement within departments? And how does Parliament pursue that? How does this committee pursue that? Where it's quite clear, I know this Parliament is driven by the political economy of issues and the rationality of politics, but how does Parliament pursue culpability when the accounting office is responsible for it? In FFC in particular, I've been clear, listen, don't even raise these things with me, deal with it, fix it, because I am not the accounting officer. If the accounting officer is taking the wrong decisions, the accounting officer must feel the consequences of those decisions. So the question is, how will this committee then, in terms of its oversight and accountability responsibility, place culpability where supposed to be charitable account? Because you can't have only a constitutional structure like the public protector taking responsibility for wrongful decisions. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But when it comes to other places within the administration, people get away with it. So it's a critical thing that we need to look at. And obviously there needs to be the consequential issues there. There's problems with information. Information asymmetry is very one. It's information asymmetry has got to do with the whole debate of principal agent. Remember the minister is the principal of a department and the agent is the DG in his department. And I mean, I'm not suggesting it happens all the time, but you probably have come across where officials say a story which a minister doesn't know of. But here's our problem as a country, is that, and it's a South African story. I've written about it publicly and other stuff, is that there's an incessant change of leadership in administrations. Over the years, if you look at the midterm, the changes in leadership, right? And then a new leadership comes. Well, not a political decision, there's nothing that one can do. But look at the scenario where you have a driver driving reform for 2 years and having the plans and everything set out. 2 years, 2.5 years. And the driver's taking a small clue around the road. And then in that period, you take the driver off, put a new driver there, blindfold him, and say, now you drive in the same direction. What's going to happen? The thing's going to crash. So there's for this committee, it's not your responsibility because it's such an executive, but it's helping to maintain an institutional memory of what was agreed to and how do you take the thing forward over the, to the end of term. Because what very often happens is that, frequently happens rather, is that you decide on something, the changes happen, and when the changes happen, a new leader takes over, and that program that was agreed to with the committee changes. And then at the end, the thing goes into a different direction. Now, for where are we sitting, over the accountability is to ensure stability, consistency, but also predictability of the outcome. And I would say to you, you, one of the things that you need to look at on chairperson is that, and part of the asymmetry issue is that it is a practice conceivable that sometimes the principal knows less. And I say this with all the love in my heart, politically, professionally, and otherwise. The principal agent issue is that principals know less than the agents. Because the agents are on the ground, the agents know the issues, the agents know the information, and the agents will tell you what you need to know. Mm-hmm. Not what you're asking sometimes. And hence, I'm saying to you that you need to ask is, and I'm not wanting to compare, but if you watch what happens, for example, in the American Congress and the way they ask questions, you can see that they like swung a whip around a chief administrator and you can't get out of it. And the type of questions they're asking. And it's just to find out what's the real information. Because sometimes we think the people that we've deployed are true political deployees. This is not my own view. But in reality, they've never been around. They've never been in the trenches. They don't understand what they're doing connects with the national development project, if you like. Connects with bringing about social, economic, and political freedoms and emancipation to people. They don't connect to it. Because many administrators become just simple politicians. The irregular, wasteful, fraud, and corruption, I'll skip that because I think that's part of your mandate. But the key thing that we never ask chairperson is what's the cost of this? What's the cost of having irregular spending to the citizens? What's the cost of wasteful expenditure to us? What's the cost of fraud to us? But here's the thing, sometimes we tend to forget about error. Because before you can get to a regular wasteful, there's also the issue of error. Government administrations are run by human beings, and human beings do make sometimes errors. The question is, what was the intent of the decision first? I'll give you a classic, is that we didn't do an error, but in 1996-97, I transferred, when I was in Treasury, 22 billion rands in the old financial year for the new financial year. It's just wrong. But if I didn't transfer those monies, the people wouldn't have received the social grants as a back pay. Nobody picked it up. We were quiet about it. But if we didn't pay those social grants, there would have been a real social protest on our doorsteps. So it's got to do with what the intent is. So we could have claimed it's an error, but we knew it's not an error. We knew we had to do it in the old financial year. Spend new money in the old financial year. So that our people get paid during the first week of April. performance information is not independently collected. This we address specifically to you, chairperson, and your support team. We have the view that your researchers needs to be jacked up. Um, because, and I'm not talking about your research, I'm talking all the researchers, because the research in Parliament has become almost like research administration, which, where I come from and where I'm sitting and what I'm doing is an indictment on research. Research is an inquiry. Research is searching for evidence. It searches for those policies which are creating collateral effect on each other. It's searching for those policies that is going the counter-cyclical way, also going in the opposite direction of what you intend to do as a parliament in your monitoring of the executive. I think there's a need that researchers old and new needs to go through a thorough training process about what needs to be done and what needs to be searched for. And I did ask previously in 2013 to other committee chairs, why don't you send ask Parliament to send their researchers to the FFC to spend a month there. When they can still be here, they can still do parliamentary work while they're still being with us. So that we and probably the budget office, which I believe can also do some good work there, and other institutions, that we actually can take people through this stuff. I mean, you can't have a researchers saying to parliamentary committees that when you shift the function from one administration to another administration, a classic would be shifting early childhood from social development to education, and then you claim there are no fiscal implications. My God, there are fiscal implications. Just the mere fact that you're shifting your function. The simple rule is finance follow function. And there are implications there. So it's service delivery implications, it's financing implications, it's policy location implications, administrative implications, so on and so forth. So we think that there needs to be a legal perspective that researchers gives you. So this committee, I would say, needs to have somebody that understands the legislation and the internal dynamics of legislation as a researcher, but also somebody that understands the finance and fiscal and economic questions, because that's what you're dealing with. You're not dealing with the politics here. This isn't a committee that deals with politics. This is a committee that deals with policy decisions as it relates to economic growth, as it relates to financial accounting and management, as it relates to fiscal risks to the African society and to the administration. So I would say, Jay, if you can get your way, then you, with your committee, to ensure that you have a legal person that also advises you. It's not sufficient just to get somebody from the legal unit of Parliament, because they're in and out. There needs to be somebody that eats and sleeps and drinks the work of this committee and understand what are the legal implications. Because the division of revenue is not simply about approving it. There's stuff in the division of revenue which actually says things which sometimes goes through, and then we're like, okay, they're probably going to pick it up along the way. And then when you start asking questions, especially other committees, they don't know that the division of revenue has already been approved. And part of that, we would recommend that it's probably conceivable sometimes, Jay, that yourselves, your good selves, find a formal or informal arrangement between yourself and those big spending departments. Those big spending, not departments, your standing committee, there will be portfolio committee there, right? The big spending portfolio committees. To deal thoroughly with some of the stuff to it. So you go in the same direction. But you can only do that if your researcher is able to provide you good content advice for your committee secretary then to help steer this thing in a particular direction. What I'm suggesting is that you're not an administration committee. There are other things that this committee focuses on. The constitution and legislation, I think we're just confirming there that there's constitutional law that deals with national and provincial legislative oversight, obviously the Parliamentary Act that also plays into that space. There's the issue of provision of resources and the necessary capacity to fulfill the mandates. The point I want to, sorry, I'm on slide 7. The point is that if a department says to you that they're underfunded, then you need to ask the simple question, okay, now where are you overfunded? The second question is, if you're underfunded, has your policies been costed? What is the collateral effect of your policies to the administration, other administration functions as it stands? Where can you actually reprioritize? I've been sitting in committee meetings, in those different committee meetings for some time, and it's probably part of my own treasury experience, but I sometimes wonder, why do committees allow people to come and complain about being underfunded by the National Treasury, when their ministers are part, I mean, Chairperson, you know about that process, when the ministers are part of setting the budget. There's a ministers committee on the budget. That budget gets to Parliament, for the Parliament to the Cabinet. The Cabinet approves it. FFC gets the division of revenue 2 days before budget day. We will say to the minister what we agree with, what we disagree with. But the minister has been part of the process because it's a horse trading that's going on there. So why would you want to use Parliament to come and sort out your battle that you have inside your own administration? I mean, I've heard even the National Prosecuting Authority, everybody debating the costing. Question is, have you costed in price what you want to do? If you've costed in price, that if you say something's going to cost you 100 million rand and you only get 2 million rand, then you can say yes. But then the next question, have you reprioritized within your own budget? Because there's fact that lies around in some of these budgets. And then the question is, how does your priorities link to the bigger priorities of the country? And clearly, as African citizens are mostly interested in the one that's going to create employment for them. Decent work. So how does it relate? Why do you outsource certain things which should actually be done inside your department? Why is your administration arm bigger than your professional arm, which is supposed to be the core function of your department? Why are we not employing young people who have degrees? I mean, I know about people that apply for jobs with some masters and doctoral studies in economics, in finance, in infrastructure, etc. They seem not to enter the public space. But also higher education, why have you not universities? Why haven't you spoken to universities? Because our universities, if you deal with that, one of the key questions that I would advise you to ask education. Why is it? And you can have a whole but date conversation about it if you like. 100 years ago and to date, in Britain and in the US, their universities understand their public role first, before they understand their private and other interest roles. Question is, are our universities serving their public interest first? Or are they more interested in being part of the higher 100 rankings in the world and the science and stuff that they put out? And how do they use the veil of institutional independence, institutional autonomy, academic freedom to keep at bay the public interest? So that for me would be the question that I'm at. Then the issue that disturbs us, Chair, is the section under intervention. And I think this is a big one. It's going to bite the Parliament, but also the political parties that's in charge of certain things. Section under intervention gets done mostly when there's a huge irregular wasteful fraud and corruption happening in the province or the administration is falling apart. Now the last one was section under intervention in North West. And the section under intervention has not been revoked formally in Parliament. But Northwest Province has, who is under Section 100, has now put 5 to 6 of its municipalities under Section 139.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that is the most archaic way of constitutional prudence to constitutional implementation to constitutional monitoring. It is unheard of. That I'm on the Section 100 and then I vote Section 139 in municipality. And I get away with it. I mean,
but
is Parliament asleep or what?
So, can I be devil's advocate? Is that intervention, somebody invokes Section 100, right? This national parliament, then you take the responsibility of the provincial government. Right, and as that authority, you also invoke Section 139. If you get my argument, that's what I'm saying, that's because the administration, the provincial administration, is already under Section 100. Is that the structure again, which I think will be invoking Section 139?
Yeah, partly what you're saying is correct. Because 139 can be evoked by national and by province. Okay? At 600 it can only be evoked by national. Now, the question is, Chair, that yes, a province can evoke 139, but this province is under 600, which basically means this province is unable to run the administration of the province. The Premier knows it, the new executive knows it, National knows it, Parliament knows it, but nobody's doing anything. It can't be right. You first have to evoke, to recall, to rescind, or whatever the correct legislative phrase is, Section 100 of North West, to give North West the authority to be running independently on their own, as the Constitution requires. But the Constitution allowed that intervention to be made. Now the question is that I'm asking, is it because, and this is the institutional memory that needs to be held together. Is it because Minister Khosazana Zuma is no longer responsible for it, because she was there, running it to the presidency? Or is it just a lapse of memory, because the argument that it's between the 5th Parliament and the 6th Parliament doesn't hold. The administration continues, even if you have a period of 5 days, there's no executive, the administration continues. Remember there's the joke that we used to make, and I don't know if you appreciate this, but the day when the president of the country gets elected, and Parliament elects the President, and between that and the day that the President gets inaugurated, there are no more ministers. Right? Similarly, when it happens in the provinces. Okay? So, you then get the situation where the administration was run by the administrators that were responsible for the intervention. And I'm not so sure whether those administrators are still in place. But we've appropriated through the division of revenue, appropriation and division of revenue, money to those problems. Right? And my issue that I'm raising here is, what is the role of this committee in relation to that section 100? Because there's a continuity on the section 100 between Northwest, Parliament, fifth term and sixth term. And somebody needs to focus on it and say, but hold on, we've done no appropriations. And the reason why I'm raising it, because it distresses us in a FLC, that how do we make sure that Parliament, how do we help Parliament, based on our advisory role, to think through some of this? That you, this committee, has approved the division of revenue. This committee has also approved the appropriation. And you going to go through the Parliament process. If you go through the Parliament process, that these monies will go to the province. Right? Your job doesn't stop there as a committee. Your job is to make sure that appropriation used is fully capacitated in terms of what the Constitution requires. Is the administration in place? Have they dealt with the issue that was raised in the Section 100, why the Section 100 was evoked? Even though Section 100 is also NCOP matter, before somebody throws that at me. You know, it's also an NCOP matter, but you've appropriated the money. You've appropriated the division of revenue. So there's a need to be able to understand, we've given money to this province, is the administration in place? Is the administration in place in terms of reflecting on what has been done? And the point is that I've asked lawyers, how does this work? You're an administration, but you think you got the authority to use to evoke 139. In fact, 139 should be evoked by national government, if so, on the recommendations of the interim. But I don't know. I mean, it's a key matter that needs to be good. We are of the view that it's going to be useful for this committee to follow its oversight. You know, it's quite clear that, I mean, I can say this without fear or favor, is that it's a good thing to call in different stakeholders to come and talk to you about different things. And lobby for certain policy positions, which we've seen over time. But you got a set of constitutional institutions which is supposed to advise you. And you can cherry pick which ones you want to use. There's the Chapter 9 institutions. Our view would be, it depends on what vote you're dealing with, it would be good for you to listen to the Public Service Commission. Depending as what are the risk of challenges of a particular vote in that. It's always useful to listen to them if they have got the right determination. What is also useful is to listen to what is general like we normally do. And there are others, the Human Rights Commission, and so on and so forth. To hear who's got no specific interest in terms of budgets, but interest in terms of the performance of budgets. Because what you sometimes get, and I'm only speaking with hindsight here, is that the people come with their own interest in terms of what are their specific interests for their own institution relative to the advice that they're giving you. And then obviously ourselves, which is a confusion thing that people raise, we are not Chapter 9, we are Chapter 13 of the Constitution. same status, constitutional status, independence and autonomy. And I wish somebody can make sure that the president got it right in his State of the Nation addresses for ministers and that. But I keep on having it wrong. There is this problem, Chair, that there are some of some executives and officials that doesn't even know or understand what the FFC is all about. So they introduce policies into parliament and legislation, and then they sub-function, and then we say to a parliamentary committee, but hold on, if you're going to entertain that legislation, I'll phone the chairperson, because it's part of my job. I know Honorable Masuta, once upon a time, reported me to Zola Square here, and the Zola Square here after the minister, I said, you can't do this. The Constitution is very clear, and the people are very clear. If you introduce legislation into Parliament that's going to shift functions, you have to consult the FSC. That's almost like a certification that we give in terms of the veracity of the decision that was made to shift a function or to introduce policies. Section 23 of the PSMA. I would ask you, please, successive parliaments has got it wrong over years. The last time we got this right, we got blossomed by ministers. That's the time when I was working in the Treasury. That was 98. But the rules are very clear, Chairperson. Any piece of... Don't let departments allow you to break the law. I think it's section 23 of the PFMA. 26. I'll get the right number for you. That says, unfettedly, definitively, that any piece of legislation that is introduced into Parliament must be costed. That's why I always talk about the costing and pricing of legislation. So, as well. So, we've been just giving you an idea as to is to part of the mechanisms of the spending that you could probably consider also calling a selective group of stakeholders, school governing bodies and colleagues in that committees to come and talk to you about certain indications. What I want to say to you, and it's driven by our own politics, school governing bodies are sometimes okay, other times they're actually standing in the way of access to quality education. And there's a need to look at what is the role and function of the school governing bodies as it comes to education. Because they keep many of our black children out of schools. And black I use very generically, the phrase of African colored and Indians. Chair, can I quickly hand over to Shane to take you through the next four slides and then I'll come back to you again. So I'll just take a break.
Before that, Prof, because we are now dealing with the institutional mechanism for effective oversight, I think let me allow the honourable members to reflect on their presentation to say exactly what is that we need to bail oversight function over. And then, if you look at the institutions, you are talking as to how you do it. But I think if honourable members can just take a bite on what has been presented and just take it from there.
Thank you, Chairperson.
The first part, Prof, would be.
I'm trying to put your words together so that they sink in the mind. You are saying this is not an administration committee. But
listening to you, Corinth, you are also saying to us, guard against a situation where you are just dishing and dishing and dishing without monitoring the end product of whatever you would have appropriated. I listened to that, Chair. While listening to that, in my mind comes the question of role play. I'm asking this from a political point of view because I'm a politician. Now we have to be careful when it comes to role play. There's intervention. There's interference. You know, Chair? There's one province we once visited in the fourth parliament. In fact, we had to do exactly what you are saying before the cabinet could actually take any decision. We had to go and take thorough research and see what was happening. You know, the premier of the province said, who are you in my province?
Did I invite you?
I don't need you here. Go out. Knowing fully well what would come, you know, after that. But we had to stamp our foot. And then, look, the premier, we are not living. Here we are. And favor the issue. We fought the issue, you know. So I'm saying, as now the Appropriations Committee, you are saying we've got this responsibility. Perhaps is there anywhere documented this particular matter that you are actually giving to us? Avoiding a situation where Chair would be seen to be interfering, you know, these are politics, Chair. 2 or 3 months down the line, they would be saying, Honorable Buthelezi is in a fight back campaign using a bomb laser and the other, you know, to fight his personal fight. Because that committee is actually now implementing is not documented anywhere. Because listening, Chair, to this input, I think it's actually what should be happening. Because we continue appropriating, but at the end of the day, we're not even sure if the bucket that we are pouring in this particular water is leaking or not. All we're doing, we're just pouring in. Chair, the last one would be perhaps it's somehow linked because fortunately Prof is arming us for the work ahead. Prof, costing policy and legislation. Would this particular committee be seen as arrogant if before we consider the figure, we demand the policy imperative, then the cost prioritized, after which then we would consider appropriations.
Thank you. Welcome. Any other bite?
Thank you, Chair. Just in terms of the constitutional role of the FFC, and that's actually is an important part of this committee doing its work, and the production of its recommendations and its many reports. I think Croft made the point earlier that it's not just a case of recommendation, almost a certification, a concurrence requirement. I'd just like to get an understanding of the experience from the FFC as to whether that certification requirement has been taken seriously, if there's been any legal rulings when recommendations and so on have been ignored, and if the recommendations that they've produced in the past have had any impact on the thinking going on in Treasury and in the way we manage budgetary processes and at the executive level and also at the committee level here.
Before you respond, Prof, anybody else? Honorable Kwan?
Chair, some of what I'm going to say will just be comments rather than questions. I think, Prof, you're quite correct in saying that it is the social impact of the policies and the programs that we implement that we're failing to track properly at times as politicians. Which is something that we must be doing. Maybe a framework must be developed at some point to give guidance as to what are some of the issues that we need to look at, because the level of experience even among us as politicians would be different in understanding especially the critical issues when it comes to certain portfolios. For example, I might be deployed in education while I have a background in finance, and when I get there I get completely lost in terms of the measurement issues, and no one is going to guide you in politics. No one is going to spoon feed you and give you all the information from a political party point of view. I think the other issue which I think is important, I'm not too sure whether this was done previously or parties did it individually, where they were trying to look at the, you were saying when it comes to giving out government guarantees, one of the issues we should look at is scrutinized performance and accountability issues around previous guarantees. Was it ever done in your experience in some of the committees here in Parliament where we looked at, say for example, it may have happened here in the Standing Committee on Finance when you spoke to them in the past, or in one of the presentations where there was an assessment of the performance of those entities with regards to the previous guarantees that were granted before they were given more bailouts or handouts. I think the other issue which I think is very critical, maybe where as another, if you like, another arm of accountability as political parties here in Parliament in particular, is one of the things I picked up in some of the jurisdictions that it works for opposition parties in particular, is that in other jurisdictions they take the issue of presenting an alternative budget very seriously and provide critical analysis. It's not just a purely ideological debate, which would, in many instances, centered around political posturing and proposing fly now and crash later policies, but it's substantive engagement on the policy proposals that are put on the table. Over the past 1 or 2 years, for instance, I've been asked, even though I don't sit, I don't know the politics in Indonesia much, but I've been asked at times by colleagues in the opposition to make contributions on their alternative budgets, but guide from an ideological perspective, and also to my own background and research to try and understand what the situation is there. And my view was there were a lot of critical accountability issues that were raised in those things. And at times, I think in some jurisdictions, even governments do take it seriously to respond to some of the issues and the questions that are raised, even though they understand that part of it will be political posturing because we are politicians. But I think it's an issue that we should take advantage of here in South Africa as well. But it can't happen when you're expected to speak for 1 minute or 2 minutes. You created your time is up, right? It takes away from the quality of the input that one would ordinarily take had that person had enough time. And people keep on arguing and saying it's a proportional system. In other jurisdictions, they would say, for example, let the opposition have its say while the ruling majority will have its way, so that you have enough time. No, I'm serious. Even in Ghana, they do that. The opposition actually in many instances speaks more than the majority party on the issues that the majority party tables in Parliament. Lastly, I think another issue that we could consider at some point, I don't know, I think the finance committees in particular are in a privileged position. They have the PBO to do the analysis on the budget. They have the Financial and Fiscal Commission. We have internal research, for example, capacity where researchers would also provide us with that information.
I don't think other portfolio committees have that luxury, which then affects at times maybe the quality of analysis or input or even recommendations that people would make on an information that they don't have an expert view, and they rely in the main on government departments, the very same entities that come and present before us. And another issue, that would obviously rely on the internal research capacity of Parliament. If there are limitations or weaknesses there, then you're unlikely to be able to play an effective oversight role. Just my inputs. Thank you.
Another case.
Look, thank you, Chairperson. Well, I think it was an eye-opening presentation on this one. More so that everyone is looking up to this committee to then give direction to budget spending of the department. Mine is actually the area of interest here that you talked about, the three constitutions, the constitution of the country, the PFMA and the MFMA, and you further raised the issue of the case study of the public protector. That coming back to us as a committee, that in future how do we then relate or read that case study, where now the public protector, for instance, is being taken to task about her wrongful or judgment or whatever that is being interpreted there to be her responsibility in terms of cost. And we have a PFMA, and there are a number of remedial actions which are proposed by the AG there, but we have not up to this stage come to terms as to how do we contrast the two. This study case of the public protector and what you are doing currently. It's going to give us a tough time to look at that. How do we do it? Because it's not just an innocent environment. It needs a quite serious management on this one. How do we look at that in order that when you say there are three constitutions that we have to, from time to time, to be referring to when it comes to our matter. Now, I just wanted to check what was your experience in terms of, I think my question is similar as the one that that Honorable has just asked about the government, guarantee framework with the Treasury. What was your take in terms of, looking at what is supposed to be a guarantee framework at the Treasury? Or what has been happening actually? Because you're talking about guarantee framework, but it's for many years. I'm not sure which period I'm referring to. Post 1994, so you're talking about 24 years or 25 years. I'm not sure, I'm just asking. Maybe you are referring to the previous term, or you have referring to the past 24 years. You have never experienced or seen the guarantee framework being something that is being considered by the President, which is important. So let me.
Honorable Dekhade Peter the Matafa, we did receive your apologies and welcome, as you
workshop mode. So we said let's be open, and there's no type of question which can't be asked and answered. Before you come in, Prof, a few comments from my side. I think one, let's just accept that FFC as professionals, when they put these things to us, they must be objective, scientific, and they should not try to be politically correct. We are politicians, we deal with that part.
Yeah.
So we want science so that we can deal with it.
As to how we
construct it, leave that to us. But I think that's what we expect from professionals. So many things have been said. I think this one should find a way of how do we progress it. The costing of legislation and policies which comes before Parliament, because it's not all legislation which come before us. But I think there's some responsibility that we say, because and I think it's given that every policy has got financial implications and therefore budgetary implications and so on and so forth. We should find a way of elevating this thing so that when it goes, when different committees consider different legislation, they factor that one in. I just thought, let me raise it before we lose it. I think Honorable Zambo, and when talks about when they talk about the framework, and then Honorable Kwanza, or you talk about documentation, even for the committee, if it was a private company, we'd be talking about the charter of the committee, what guides us on it, so that we know very, very well it doesn't depend who's sitting around this table. I think there's a question around that, and what do we do about it, so that individuals and collectives in our own spaces can be able to interact with that and make sure that we understand why in the same page. I think it's something that we definitely need to see as how we concretize that. One biggest problem, which I think comes here, when, and I think it has been raised by the professor, when do we as the committee from Parliament interact with the budget? And the time constraints, for instance, if you have to take the budget that we are coming from, with the best of intentions, there are so many things that perhaps we could have wanted to do. But even under a normal budget cycle, as to when do we try to influence the budget? Because once the Minister of Finance comes and presents that budget, when you touch something on that budget, irrespective of what political party you come from, once you start touching it, then all types of things come up. If you are not sensitive to certain things and so on. I don't know what we say, because for me, for instance, if you talk about the participation of the provinces, of municipalities and so on, it happens before it comes to Parliament. But when it comes to us, the minister that announces, in fact, people don't know that, for a lack of a better word, that when the Minister of Finance presents a budget, it's more of a proposal to Parliament. Mm-hmm. They take it as a fait accompli. The economic agents, the economic actors, and so on, once they see the thing, they don't expect a Parliament, even in this committee, to start changing and so on. So again, there's a mind shift that we need to deal with there. And again, I think it's an education process that we should also try to get involved in, or perhaps Parliament, because I'll tell you, even some honourable members here in Parliament, they don't understand that what this committee and what their power as Parliament is, as far as the budget is concerned. So I'm saying there's the all those things. If you look at our mandate, at this committee, there's nothing we can't touch because we appropriate money to them, so we need to follow money. There's nothing we can't touch. So it's also very important that you must pick and choose, otherwise you end up being everything and being everywhere and being less effective. So again, as to how we deal with those things, also very, very, very important, because let alone trampling on other committees' toes as to how we deal with it, it's one thing, but I'm just saying in general, for our own effectiveness, it's also very important that we should pick and choose and say that's what we're going to be. And for me, it's about the high impact areas,
yeah,
irrespective of how we define that, in terms of the budget or in terms of what can happen to the public. Now, I think the big thing which, year in year out, whenever we present budget and we debate, we characterize our budget as a progressive budget, as a pro-poor budget, so on and so forth, and with good intentions. But if you look at the indicators that we're all familiar with, if you look at what has happened to inequality, this being a pro-poor budget and so on, it's not getting better. The Gini's coefficient is getting worse. You look at unemployment rate, again, it's not getting better. You look at poverty levels, again, and so there's something which is not happening. In the current financial year, we've approved about 1.4 trillion rand expenditure, government expenditure. 2020-21 is about 1.54, and then in the MTF, we've got about 4.65 trillion rand. And we come here and we run a risk of being a woman in an Ibimali. We have been security guards over this money, year figures when it comes and it goes. These indicators, which are very important, we are not making a dent. And we have never been, we have never sat down and said exactly what is the problem, because these things are not getting better. This 4.65 trillion rand in the MTF, a simple thing, when you say you want to deal with poverty, do we know how much of this? And I can tell you very little goes to the people, to the targeted people. You can say you want to alleviate poverty and so on, and where that money goes to is something else. So I think when we bring the CPO here, and I think we trigger the CPO, they must come here, Chief Procurement Office, and try to understand that what we appropriate, where does it go? We can't continue sitting here and spend all these hours and doing what I've just characterized as people who are looking over this money, just comes and it goes. But the people who are supposed to be most impacted by this budget, yeah, it's not happening. So I'm saying that,
Chair, sorry. Let me forewarn Honorable Nkwanko.
No.
But if that's what we are, and that's what we are, we must recognize it so that we can correct it. So that we can correct it. I'm worried. I'm worried to see of looking at these money that these big books we have got them here, they've got billions, they've got trillions, some of these numbers we can't even read to them.
Yeah.
Right? But as to where exactly they end up, it looks like it becomes less of our concern.
Yeah.
That also talks to which I think therein, when CPO comes, the Preferential Procurement Act and its amendment and so on, I think we need to be taken on board, because that defines how this budget is going to be spent. And I think it's very important that the committee and by extension Parliament get briefed and understand what that exactly means. When the Triple PFA before this, there was, I don't know how many of us understand the 90-10 rule, which was there. which basically was saying that 90% of any procurement depends on price, right? And 10% in everything that you want to solve, the employment, DE, and so on and so forth. That's a non-starter. That's a non-starter. It can't solve the problems. In fact, one of the reasons why we are here, I think it's that very same route. Because you know what happens? It's so easy to come down on price. Come down on price, but the changes on those prices throughout the lifespan of the project, they will come with all types of things that are going to tell you about the exchange rate. The exchange rate has changed, and therefore must change the price and so on. But when they put in a bid, those were not the issues, right? But a lot of people were taken out of that process because of it. And you can't change it, because if you change it as an official, you are guilty of something. You would have broken the PSMA. So I'm trying to say these are the things that we need to pick up on. Prof, you may want to comment on some of them, but at the end of the day, we say we are approving a progressive budget, a pro-poor budget. We are saying we are dealing with a budget which must deal with unemployment, which must deal with poverty, which must deal with inequality. Those are big indicators, right? Can all this, what we are approving, what goes through us, how do they impact on those things? I just thought, let me make those comments, Prof. And then we come to the institutional mechanism for effective oversight, because I think what we've been doing is to define the problem and so on, what to do with the problem.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was just making sure that the names of board members, and I don't get it wrong. Thank you. And the honourable members, there are two ways to make policy in South Africa and in the world. One is where you have a formal policy and you introduce it by documentation. The other is when a powerful leader of a political party or the president or a minister makes a public statement. Okay. And which becomes policy. And teaching in this field for a couple of years is that when the president speaks, he sets the policy terrain. The president did say in his first State of the Nation address, remember the first one, the president would deliver three State of the Nation addresses in close to 2 years. His first State of the Nation address, he did say that ministers will account to Parliament. Ministers will be subjected to the oversight and accountability of Parliament. Okay? He said on behalf of his party, and he also said on behalf of the government that he's leading. So there can't be a way that you see, I always say to staff, newspapers are like ugly stuff about me. You know, they wrote about I am first in the FFC when I came in. And the guy phoned me and said, well, if I deal with fraud and corruption in terms of what the forensic report requires me to do, then I'm high interest. Because we'll stamp out fraud and corruption. And there's no two ways about it. So the point I'm making is that becomes then the narrative that fraud and corruption will not be allowed in this organization. Okay? And we're dealing with it that way. So I'm not the best of people. I mean, I'm not a favorite. That's probably why, but one day a red eye, the next day a pink eye, so I don't know, okay, somebody's not putting out good enough, hard enough for me to be here, you know? But here's the thing, when the president made that statement, he was actually saying to you,
one eye plus eye fit. Without at peace.
Yeah. made that statement, it suggested that you as members of parliament, you need to exercise your constitutional responsibility of keeping the executive accountable. So when Honourable Buthelezi and yourselves ask certain questions, it can't be a pushback of anything. So I won't even, you see, there are so many noises in South African society. So many noises. The noises started increasing in the midterm of Thabo Mbeki's second, President Thabo Mbeki's second term. And the noises is going to go on. Because Parliament is a contested space, South African society is a contested space, and the history of studying South Africa used to be number one of the countries that's got the highest most politicized people in the world. It's just because of our history. I mean, if you oppress for decades, then surely you have a view. That's why I say when people, everybody make a comment about the state of the nations over here, it's our history. People have been fought against oppression, people are now fighting for different freedoms and our democracy. So people will have to say, the question is, what do you listen to? The newspapers has got its own interests. Media's got its own interests as usual. They claim to be the fourth estate, so let them be the fourth estate. I mean, it's just a given thing that you'll find the media that's A, for or against different political forces in the country. My issue is that if this committee pushes greater forms of accountability and reporting, then this committee will be doing its constitutional responsibility. In fact, it will implement the law of parliament. In fact, you are implementing the convention that our citizens have invested in you as all parliamentarians, because they want you to be their public representatives and keep the executive accountable, keep the administration accountable, keep public servants, full-time employed, and the elected accountable. So I don't think that's a problem. The problem is got to do with what type of questions are you asking? What set of information do you require to be able for you to understand exactly what the task at hand is? And let me jump to the point that the chairperson has raised about different committees, and I'll come back to one last question. Is that if you, some of us study Parliament and what's happening in Parliament, and a very close friend of mine wrote about the administration in Parliament, right? And what it says in it is that the work of Parliament is actually in committees, not in the plenary. Now, I couldn't understand that until I read through the input that she gave me and checked it and said, okay, this is actually true. Because what I've picked up in my own engagement with Parliament since 1997 is that when it comes to part for committees, you actually all dealing with the public good. You are amazingly on the same page, you know, and you interrogate the issues and you agree with each other because you know there's a common responsibility. I don't know what happens when you get into the plenary. It's probably me. I don't know what happens in the plenary. In there. But that's a different thing. And amazingly, the committees are supposed to work together. So when you... There was a time that I was arguing that one of the strongest committees ought to be the Committee of Social Development. Right? And there was a total disagreement with me. And the reason was simple. That committee is responsible to deal with 400 billion rands, if not more. That social grants money, contracting around the social grants money, the whole thing about making sure people get their money on time. I was responsible for the establishment of SASA. That's why I can say to you this. That committee is never being as strong as supposed to be. That's why when you deal with issues around social grants, money, there's something going wrong, your researcher and your content advisor need to get a report. from his or her counterpart in those committees, so that they inform you, this is what's been going down in that committee. Here are the issues that committee has raised. Here are the issues that you need to know. So there's no inconsistency between what you want and what that committee has addressed. Now, if you look at across parliament, there's always inconsistencies. And it's got nothing to do with the politics or the political parties. It's got to do with that interface that is not working. And I'm saying to you in no uncertain terms, Chairperson, it's got to do with the management administration of parliament and its the team, not the parliament, not the principals. I'm talking about the teams that appoint researchers and content advisors and how that orientation needs to happen. So that the content advisors and researchers know that there has to be a structural link between what they are doing in their committee and what is going on other committees. It can't be a silo approach. That's the point. It can't be a silo approach. I've also produced just committee secretary of this some years ago. You're probably not going to remember it. So what happens in the finance committee, they need to get a report, share those reports, so it comes to you, so you also know what's going on in the finance committee. You need to know what's happening in the one that you all identify as your big ones, like you indicated. The impact of policies, I think our experience, and I'll share this with the chairperson, is if you find committees, you know, every year we do a couple of things with committees. One, we table our division of revenue recommendations. Two, we give our response to the division of revenue. Oh, okay, because we have, compared to others, we have a comparative advantage because we get it first. So before the minister speaks in parliament, we would have seen the numbers, etc., etc., and how it works. So we give our review to it. Then we give our review to the macro framework and that. Every year we come in, and it's almost like parliament applying a malicious compliance issue. That you listen to structures like the FFC because it requires from you to look at us. And then down the road, not this committee, down the road I get asked, so what's the impact of the recommendations made by the FFC? Then I say, but I can't tell you what the impact is. Because you haven't indicated as parliamentary committees whether you agree with our recommendations or whether you disagree with our recommendations. Some of the issues around higher education, we've spoken to parliament about. If parliament listened to us at the time or hear us or considered our recommendations, we would not have had the fees must fall. I mean, I'm being a little bit rich about it. But clearly we would have given you more answers before we got to the fees must fall. If Parliament considered the cost of norms approach, where we were saying that we need to cost policy so that we know that we're not going to get in Ziki-Siki and other places of the Eastern Cape, or in KZN, the whole issue around our children falling in put 11 trees, because we did a proposal on infrastructure. I mean, our proposal was quite so specific around infrastructure in education, in health, in welfare, roads, etc., etc. So, the impact of policies is hard to measure if you don't say to us, we agree with these things, and then we know. Okay? This is what we're going to help you pursue. We don't get that from Parliament. In fact, to rub insult to injury, we don't even know what Parliament thinks about our recommendations chambers. Now surely, I mean, we're all worried about being employed and having in serving the citizens of the country to our constitutional status. But if Parliament doesn't like what the FFC says or doesn't want the FFC, then Parliament must, by a majority, two-thirds majority, change the constitution and say there shouldn't be an FFC any longer. And the same goes for other Chapter 9 institutions. We can't be investing in institutions and we don't utilize the benefit of these institutions for making you, because our job is to make you smarter. Our job is to make sure that you got, that ask the right set of questions, our job is to make sure that you put evidence-based information in front of you. So the whole question of alternative budgets, I don't think, I mean, I can't speak for the politicians. Like you say, politicians do what politicians need to do. But where I'm sitting, if you ask the right set of questions relative to what the majority party has indicated its priorities are, then, and you see, you ask questions around how the funds flow around those priorities, and where there's a overheating in certain places, where there's a underfunding in other places, it might give you the alternative view to it. It's not necessarily an alternative budget, but it helps to deal with the system looking. Because, like some would say to you that, okay, I wanted to use the 10th example, and I forgot a few politicians there. I can't use the 10th example. But the issue is that you rather deal with the stuff inside and ask the right questions based on economic, social, and political questions that you have, based on the values that you have. And I think part of it, in my experience, I don't know why it's happening. Peters will probably know this, is that Trevor Manuel, I mean, notwithstanding the policies that he was propagating at the time, always used to ask, why isn't it that the members of the ANC, when I appear before them, either in Parliament or in a committee, don't ask me the hard questions? They allow the opposition to ask the hard questions. Now, surely it can't be you pushing back. I mean, I don't think, I mean, if our egos are that fragile, then surely we shouldn't be a politician. Then surely they shouldn't be politicians. Because to be a politician is going to do with the balance of power at a given moment, you know? And to be asked and interrogated about something which doesn't belong to you shouldn't be a problem. So I think you should. I mean, that's what I'm saying, sometimes I get like trikies, you have to talk. Then I say, you can talk to ministers. But the minister can't be continuously be at the wag the dog issue, where his administration wags him in a particular direction, forgetting about the priorities of what needs to be done. And I think that the whole question about the impact issue on the Gwangwa is a difficult issue, because, like I said earlier, impact doesn't get measured in 1 year, 2 years spells. There's a longevity to impact, and it requires time and requires clear question. That's why when we talk about outcome based, I say that we doing South African, it's like when I speak to you, you say no, you know, but in reality you're not actually saying no, it's just you're entering into a conversation, you know, just to have a discussion. So when we talk South Africans, I mean, I always listen, that we use the word no, that actually means actually yes, I agree with you, you know, but here's my view on it. So the issue of impact needs to be looked at quite differently, and the outcome base needs to be quite different, because we define it quite differently in the South African setting. Because you can't measure impact in a year. Can't be. Not our policy. Whoever says it can happen, I can say to you they're wrong. Impact works 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. So if I can just run through the others quickly, this slide basically speaks to the ways that we think that the work of Parliament could be strengthened.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes, sir.
I'm not going to allow you to pass this one.
Did you
make
a point on this?
No. We raised the issue of that this country has identified three biggest challenges to this economy and to the people of South Africa. We identified that as poverty, unemployment, and inequality, right? And I don't hear you saying, how do we get to that? Because you are saying,
despite all these trillions that we are approving, we are still going in the wrong direction. I want to hear your comment, not necessarily your solution.
Okay, that's quite a hard one, because, but the...
Professors are there to deal with that.
And there's one
Okay. the issue of poverty, poverty is quite stubborn in South Africa. Because it's about income poverty, asset and other asset poverty that we're experiencing in the country, which also relates to what are the type of interventions that needs to be made. I remember in 1994 when Treasury went to President Mandela and said there's not enough money because the country was bankrupt, that there's not money for an expansion on South Africa's ground. And the president said, I don't care what you do, you'll find that money for children. But then there needed to be interventions around that. That's why we have a child support expansion program. The issue of poverty is that I think what we need to do is to review the interventions made to date. There's the intervention on social grounds, which is a high risk to the fiscus, even though it has its ability to bring some relief to households, needs to be looked at. At a certain period in time, people were raising the whole question of the basic income grant as a measure to deal with that. And at that time, it was not but maybe now we are at a mature political space, we need to open up a conversation again. There's the issue, you see, on the basket of services that we give, comparatively speaking, we actually spending, if you put all the resources together, we're spending more than many countries on education of the child and the inputs that we give there. From free education to basic education to health to nutrition programs. We're struggling with employment. And part of the role that this committee could play is if you pin it down is to ask departments, your budget is supposed to be create to lead to productive outcomes. Where are you increasing greater opportunities for employment in the budget? And not employment inside the administration, but employment outside the administration. Because what invariably happens is that when we do new policies, we tend to set up new administrations instead of looking at what job opportunities does our policy interventions make and what opportunities does it do with regard to employment outside. Where is it going to do with social infrastructure? Health, education, welfare, the arts, etc., or whether it's got to do with economic infrastructure, whether it's got to do with those economic activities that's happening there. The other link to that is the whole issue of, which I'm loath to say it because I don't like it, the way that has slided to almost insignificance, is expanded public works programs. Chair, what has happened is and I'm worried that my ideological position is going to come out of this, but there's been. I must guide it, okay. Once upon a time when we grew up, there used to be people doing honorable jobs cleaning the streets from the councils. Cleaning the, fixing our, I lived in the towns of Coxton, the Bontyville, where they came to clean your infrastructure, sewage systems, electricity were fixed, fencing were fixed, and all jobs that was with the municipality. What happened to those jobs? The majority of those jobs are outsourced. And it hasn't improved anything. Look at Hillbrow, it's still as dirty as can be. And the question is, how do we push back on the whole issue of outsourcing? Because outsourcing is provide opportunities for fraud and corruption. So there's a need to look at the whole question of outsourcing. So I would ask directly a department, how many jobs are you creating? So that this, we stop making embarrassing statements to say that we created 50,000 job opportunities. That's not a job. We're talking about a decent, probably permanent 3 to 5 year job that's in place. That would be my question. If you deal with employment and you're able to make a dent on poverty, then you will be able to deal with the whole question of inequality. Now, the inequality issue is quite deep. And I think I would advise you to ask Professor Chris Ulemeki and others to come and speak to you about that question on the whole issue of inequality. And there's some interesting ideas not to make this a romantic conversation. Because the inequality runs rather very deep, and we're going to be in trouble as a country. And in fact, we are facing a situation where if we don't deal with the more than 3 million youth that's not in employment, that is not in an education facility or training facility, that's enough people to create a revolution in the country. That's enough. You don't need more than that. And you know the youth has got a particular muscle of mobilization. So I think we have a problem with that. But to sit with the 70-odd, 0.7-odd percentage to of the Gini coefficient is a problem. It's a deep problem. And it's going to go deeper. So I would say that we need to push. I believe in two places of employment creation. I believe we need to give a stimuli to the private sector to create employment opportunities and that the industries work on it. And I also believe that governments create public employment opportunities and new ones, Chair, because it's not going to help us to expand current places because it's already been saturated. So there's a need to be innovative around these things, and I think just to talk about the fourth industrial revolution is insufficient. It's just an idea. It will remain an idea if our children, if we continuously make education equipment expensive, if we don't deal with the import taxes around. I still don't get it, Chair. We know the majority of our educational books for universities and stuff needs to be imported, and we still ask import taxes. Computers and other equipment, we still ask import taxes. So there's a need to also look at the taxing regime around that. The other issue which nobody touches is it just becomes a public conversation in this time. But I think a committee like this would be at a great advantage if it interrogates late St. Peter Blanche's proposals on the welfare tax. It doesn't belong to, the idea doesn't belong to a particular political party. It's an idea that comes from the First, Second World War, post those war, as part of the reconstruction and development of those countries where they looked at the welfare tax. An example that we can't use is when we always praise the tigers, the Asian tigers, development states. But what we actually sometimes forget is that, or don't know, He said when these countries were taken over by the Maluki, they arrested all the industrialists in their countries. They put the industrialists into prison, like you were put into prison for politics in Robben Island. There they were put into prison for politics. They were taken into prison because they had too much of the assets of the country. So industrialists were put into prison. They were told, they were left there for 2 or 3 weeks without any charges, and they were afraid what's going to happen to them in prison. They were robbed in prison. And then the military government came back and said, right, we want 70-80% of your assets for the state. on top of that, all of you develop us a new industrial policy for the country. So sometimes we want to take the trajectories of economic development of other countries, not knowing the history of those countries. We don't have what China has. We have a constitutional democracy. So we need to operate within the confines of our constitution and make sure that we do the things that need to be done. The land issue is a big issue. For productive purposes, in terms of increasing the economy, but on the other hand also dealing with these things properly. If you've seen the CNN program of Global Public Square, they show that. I mean, it's one of the arguments that don't seem to... I mean, we can't talk about these things. Land appropriation without compensation in South Africa, it's not a new thing. It's not a new thing. It happened in 1913 with the Land Appropriation Act, where 80% of the land was taken from black people. Why are we not using those arguments to deal with issues of inequality? It's not a new thing. We're allowing the narrative of the dominant interests to run its way and then we chase it as a country. I mean, the facts are clear. 1913, there was a Land Appropriation Act without compensation. The brutality of that threw all of us in reserves and in townships that sprang up after the defeat in the Western Cape. But it was there, 1913. I mean, the 1913 Act is there. I mean, people want to go check the archives. It's in Bartman. That Act is there. It's new. So we don't have to rewrite history. The truth is there. So those are the comments I can make for now on it. But I think there are taxing interventions that need to be made. There's the land reform question that needs to be dealt with. There's the import on certain goods and services that needs to be looked at. There's the dumbing down to increase the VAT-free goods and services on it. And then there's stimuli that needs to be given by government to new industries, not to the old ones. We need to think anew. And then there's obviously creating new jobs to businesses from the property firms.
Prof, you can proceed. I think I just wanted to tease this debate because I think it's a debate that we need to engage on. Especially when you talk about poverty and inequality, so that we know how those things manifest themselves. I know these are the things that we all know because we live with them on a daily basis. But I think the science behind it really needs to ensure that we try to go on the same page so that we correctly diagnose the problem. So that you don't skate on the surface when you deal with these things, I think that you rearrange the chairs on a Titanic, and you think that things are going to change. So I think it's important that when we engage here, and I remember, I think we need to get again some experts to deal with these things because these are very deep things that we are trying to solve. So if we have got a wrong diagnosis, we'll always come up with the wrong cure. So it's very important that we understand these things so that we can have a proper prescription. Prof, please then proceed. I think that is all. Honorable Mukwan.
Just one input, Prof, before you proceed.
I agree with you entirely when you say maybe the issue of alternative budgets might not be entirely useful in some contexts. But I think the point I was trying to make is that, look, in many instances, the alternative budget is just political taking. Many of the things, we said it's a workshop, right?
Yes.
Many of the things sometimes we propose aren't really alternatives in the true sense of the word, because of ideological things. Obviously, because say we're friends of the left, so whatever proposals are put on the table are going to are likely to be significantly different from what is put on the table by the AEC, right? But you'd have a few instances where whether you have ultra leftists or far right, right wingers, or all of that would come up with other things. But I think what I picked up with what it does is that it almost creates an expectation for political parties in particular to deal with the budget in a very methodical fashion. Because now what is happening is that you're dealing with in economics, you know, you deal with variables. So our discourse currently when it comes to the budget, I find it nitpicks certain issues. It loses sight of the bigger picture in many instances. Because now we are in this phase of political soundbites, about getting soundbites and trading on social media, rather than being able to come up with substantive inputs on whatever proposals are on the table. I feel in my view, if we were to do that, say in this context, to take the ANC out of the equation, it would create an environment that is conducive to have discussions around amending the budget, which enable us to actually exercise the mandate of this committee to some extent. But as long as the discussions around these issues tend to be superficial, we are not going to move to a point where we can be able to exercise our mandate in this committee on matters that are very important to us. I just wanted to make that point.
Thanks, honourable member. I think we need to pick up on, because I think we agree with the principle. I think the main thing is the how part of it, how and when. As I said, so that we have. Prof.
I would challenge all of the honourable members, Jay, in this house, and even yourself. You need to watch the parliamentary chamber. We hear all of it. And you listen to sometimes the debating committees and the questioning of extending the role of oversight and accountability. And then you also listen to what's happening in Parliament. And the 1 minute to 20 minutes, I mean, the system works. And you listen to the issues. And then you yourself will be surprised that, I mean, we're having an open conversation, but the issue on the table is not being addressed by different people that stands on the podium. And it's got to do with the nature and extent of how Parliament operates. I mean, I can't say anything to it, but I sometimes think that, yo, really? Are you my representative saying that? Can't be. The issue is about this matter, and you're talking about something that's got nothing to do with it. And what it raises is how do we have to solidify the idea of what we put on the table? And I'm hopeful that the six parliaments would really be better than the first two parliaments, if you know what I mean. The first parliament and the second parliament. Right? Because, comparatively speaking, because that's how long, that's how we, in that space where we compare terms, you know, is that there were the political trade-offs. I don't remember Honorable Master Sulu when she was in the House Committee. Said that she praised the development of the Health Act at the time. But in the same speech she said, she raised issues of accountability of the minister, the issues around consulting around this act, the issues around implementing this act, the issues around the financing, but also the issues around how we need to do these things in terms of serving them. And in the same speech she also took on at that time it was because Van Gogh Union in Parliament. So that was one of the speeches that I picked up over time where a member of Parliament, and I'm not suggesting anything, just speaking to that matter, was able to speak to what is in the public interest, criticizing our own party via the head of minister, and maybe it was the issue of stature, the minister, but also taking on the opposition. And I would invite you, I mean, it's not my TV channel, just watch your own TV channel, and you'll be really surprised. I mean, you're even not going to get to the extent where you're going to check your own party members, you know, but that's not the issue. What they do, why are you not dealing with it? Because we're all in this thing. It's a national interest. And I sometimes don't see the national interest flowing through in the way this is done. Because, but at the same side, there's sometimes the majority party members that doesn't want accountability to flow through. Okay, that protects individuals. I mean, I've never seen a party, a committee protecting a CEO of an institution. I mean, if you protect the CEO, you just fight the minister and do something wrong. I would rather protect the minister and just fight the operator with the CEO. But that's Parliament for you. But please look at that. I mean, I sometimes when I used to teach, I used to say, come my class, policy class, let's go watch the parliamentary channel, I'll record it for you. And sometimes you have MPs sitting in that class from a provincial and national legislature. And I do it purposely, and they're like, that's not me. And I said, but that's you. What value did you add to the conversation? Because now she's in the club, he or she's in the club.
Continue the presentation. we'll come back on that one, so let's just be sure we
do. So that speaks to the I mean, the reason why I say those things is directly to that slide, so I don't have to go into it. It's the strength of Parliament, and the strength of Parliament is going to be the apex of reporting and accountability. The matter that we want to raise with you also, Chair, is that we would motivate you and do everything to suggest to you, you need to increase your visibility by repeat visits to those big projects as a committee, those big infrastructure projects or those big priorities that has consequences for economic growth, social and human development. We would advise you to go to do those site visits. I'm going to repeat, don't go once. Don't warn them you're coming either. Just go there because that's your job as Parliament. You can go. In fact, you can walk anytime into my office as Parliament and ask, where is the chairperson? Why is he not here? And if the staff says to you, but he's somewhere, then they'll say to you, where he is. And the same ought to happen with you going to any department. You don't have to make prior arrangements. I never seem to get that. There's no surprises to certain facilities. And I remember that I still don't get it. In either, I don't know whether you remember from the Free State, either in Lejuela Putswa or the provincial committee of standing committee of public accounts were locked out. They couldn't come into the municipal offices. And by who? By a municipal manager. Now by all accounts, a manager must be sacked. There's no two ways about it. So there's no consequence of this is that. So we're saying to you that you need to strengthen a recommendation and engagement with ourselves or the general, the Public Service Commission and other research institutions. But I also want to recommend to you, the Parliament always engages, and I'm very rich on this one, extremely rich. The Parliament always engages liberals and neoliberals perspectives. I don't know where this conservatism comes from. You know, we like the things that is okay, that's stable, that kind of, we never engage people who are on the left side of things, left ideologies. I mean, I've got my close friend, Professor Chris Maluleki, was the chief, was the special advisor to a minister, and the whole world attacked the man. And he's a professor in economics. He's one of the people that wrote the paper against responding to Piketty's book on capital. And it's a black professor at Wits University. And people attack him. But if a white professor said the same thing, then it would be okay. So how did we get from a fight of non-racialism where we need condonement? I mean, I don't want to be condoned by, and I'm not being racist, I'm just putting the point out there for you. I don't want to be condoned or validated by a white academic. I mean, that would be the greatest problem ever. I write what I like, we respond to things, we respond to evidence. But even in the minds of black people, it's okay to listen to only white people when they speak about the economy. Or what about finances? Mm-hmm. About policies? Yeah, it can't be that bad that we have been so intolerant about Bantu education that we can't even see the devil in front of us. And I'm suggesting to you, open up the space. There are very good black academics. They can tell you better stories and better interaction and better advice information than I can give you, that we can give you together. It can't be that you, this committee needs to, as a accountability in representing the public, you need to have access to the liberal views, the neoliberal views. I don't know what sits on the left, you know? Because depending where you are, it can be Marxist, it can be Trotsky, it could be whoever, you know. You can be Adam Smith, we sit on the right of it, you know. You can be Milton Friedman, the ideologies that you have. But I'm suggesting just open up the space. Please, just open up the space so you get a real set of views of what is going on with our economy and what is wrong with our economy. It's not okay to say gear is the problem. It's not okay. It's not going to work anymore. Because gear was alright. I mean, I will be the one who defended about Moses. It was okay at a certain moment in our history. But some of these things are no longer okay. You know? There's a classic debate. I was involved in the municipal ESCOM issues. You know? Where I was chairing this committee. And a lion's share of the people that came before this committee wanted to protect ESCOM. And I was saying, but are we saying we're going to let our municipalities go down, break down another set of government? So I'm pleading with you to open up the space and allow people like Chris to come and talk to you on different things. You don't have to agree with it. But at least you need to hear the other view. And as a scholar, I was not saying to people, the only way to understand Marxism is to read and read Marx to be able to defend your position. Right? And then you can be a neoliberal. But if you haven't read Marxism, how can you attack Marxism? Just based on your own neoliberal position.
So perhaps the opposite is also true. If you have a red capitalism, how can you attack it capitalism?
Exactly.
Yeah. Just balancing the equation, Prof.
And then there's the issue of cultural imperialism, you know, where you put other values. Imperialism doesn't just work in they come and take away your country and colonialize it. It's also the idea that comes with it. And you're certainly sometimes stuck in a particular time war. We also want to say to you that the act, the MBAPAARMA, I can't remember what that long phrase is all about, but it's essentially that act Hello, Parliament, you know, if Parliament is supposed to, for the people of the Eastern Cape in particular, Parliament is supposed to be a very empowering place. Make sure that people understand what you're talking about. Make sure the information is clear. But Parliament is a place where they do abbreviations. Abbreviations is the greatest form of post-democracy disempowerment. You don't want people to understand what you're talking about, that's why you have all these abbreviations. You know? So, but more importantly, the Act provides for financial and fiscal status institutions in terms of what we're saying. You need to know what the revenue is. And the revenue comes from different streams. It's the budget that's been allocated and it's income generation. Certain departments raise income. Whether it's school fees, whether it's hospital fees, whether it's fees at a particular institution. And in fact, one of the things that you could ask, and I don't know whether I raised it with this committee chair, is that South Africa has 4 school holidays. I don't know whether we want our children to be educationally poor. Why must our children, who are South African citizens, pay during school holiday to go to the proletarian, to go to a game farm, to go to the swimming pool? If you live like some of us, during the past, we lived in other countries, especially in the UK, in the States. The first thing they ask you, what's your ID number? Give us your ID card. And when they discover that you're not a native of that country, then you pay. In South Africa, everybody pays. Even the poor must pay just to go to those recreational centers and that. Now surely this, that's an education opportunity on the one end for our children. So you can't be surprised if our children doesn't understand how the ocean works and what is in the ocean. Oh, the planetarians works and the sky and the sky rockets and mountains and the sun and the moon and stars and that. If you don't allow these children to have free access to public institutions, I mean really, and even the agent, it can't be a revenue element. So I'm suggesting to you that we need a greater activist parliament and a greater activist committee around some of these things. If you can give tax relief to business, why can't you give tax relief to our children? I mean, really.
And Prof, to agree with you, the system is very elitist in that sense. Because then you must be a university student, have a student card in order to qualify for discounts. If I'm from Songchai School, I qualify for nothing because I have no student card, even though I'm a student.
Yeah.
I'm still in the education system.
Quite correct.
It's because we treat us, we say 55 million, we're now 58 million people in the country are dishonest. That's what we're saying. We're saying that indirectly through our policies. We're also saying to our agents, our older persons, because their husbands bought them a house over years out of pocket to whether they're uneducated, not matric, and they bought a house, and then the wife remains, the husband dies. The wife can't afford to pay for electricity or to pay the taxes. You can't get access to a social grant. Not understanding that asset of that house is an asset of the family. It has been worked over and invested for years. Now they must pay property taxes. So municipalities and provinces get away with property tax increases. Something wrong in the system. You ask, how do we deal with the inequality? Let's start dealing with that question around property taxes. And especially in the low middle income areas. houses that were given to people by the apartheid government, especially in colored communities and some of the Bantustans, etc., etc. Those houses are not being taxed, property taxes. And people don't. There's no income coming to that household, say, person, other than the social drama. Right? And the only secure income for some families is to put all social grants together. So sometimes our policies are working in the opposite direction. We want our people to be poor, to be able to get access to government services. It's wrong. So we're saying, even when they talk to you about income generation, we need to look at it. We need to look at it. So the spending I need to look at, investments. What are the investments that are being made? What's the return on investment? And what are the liabilities of the department? Because there are continuing liabilities. Litigation, etc., creates continuing liabilities on department entities and agencies. We need to know that. And here's an opportunity for this committee. The president has announced that he...
Sorry, can I interrupt you? Just to say we have got 30 minutes because at 12:30 we must break, because we should be preparing for another meeting at 1:30. So.
Thank you, Chair. We got a golden opportunity here. The president said that we need to reorganize the state. So why can't you use the budget, the appropriation process, to start influencing the reorganization of the state? Classic example. And there's an old South African story. When the president promulgated chairperson departments to the presidential promulgation. Because some departments get established by legislation, others through presidential proclamation. Why must the province follow the same tune? Why does the province want to look the same as national government? I mean, I don't diminish the post, but the premier is not a small president. And the mayor is not a small premier. They need to be organized around their constitutional functions. They don't have to be organized the same as the presidency and national government is organized. Why do we allow this to happen? And as an example, we create expansion of the administration. And we're not creating social infrastructure and opportunities for our citizens and economic. I mean, it's like mini presidents, you know?
Yeah.
I was with one premier and I said, don't do this. Don't do this. But he didn't do it. Just stick to what you have, what you need to do as a function. But then he sees others does it and then, okay, if they can do it, we can do it. It doesn't have to happen that way. So I think you can use this, the system, the processes in this committee, and the target of the appropriation and division of revenue long before that to start influencing the reorganization of the state. You can. And one of the classic things that's going to face you is the special appropriations around this one. Transmission, generation, and distribution. And how does that then lock into the Department of Public Enterprises? In fact, the Minister of Public Enterprises will probably not say it to you. The boards of ESCOM, of the boards of public entities, and the CEOs has got more powers than the Minister. So it's a nice position to be in, to be honest about that. But really, where does the substantive power and authority lies in terms of making sure you implement what government needs to implement? And then the thing is, gets a discussion. Where's Parliament's role in it? Where's the appropriations role in it? So the point I'm making is that this committee and the finance committee, as what we would refer to as the constitution, financial constitution committees. Because remember, finance drives finance policy, finance legislation drives changes in countries. I mean, I don't have to say that to you, but you know, we passed the agriculture, manufacturing, we're now in the financial services. The financial services is holding the power of change. So,
yeah.
I think you could probably consider that. We think at the operational level that we would say to you more specifically that you need your advice, you need your researchers and your content advisors to get into this, not here at a macro level. They must dig 3 feet deep. That's a 3 feet deep matter, because if you read all the reports to date, it's at the surface. It has to be 3 feet deep, right? In terms of medium-term expenditure and strategic priorities, measurable objectives are stable by national budget. There needs to be a strong and solid link between what the minister president has said, what the minister has said, what does the vote say, and how does all those things link to the priorities, and especially those priorities that this committee is chasing. Have to consider that. Because if you raise those priorities, then nobody can fight it. It won't be a pushback. If you raise those priorities in relation to policies, it won't be a pushback. If you raise those priorities in terms of the output that needs to be delivered, it can't be a pushback, including the throughput that's required. You will pick up, and we picked up in our own, that's why we changed it, that a substantive part of the strategic plan of a department is probably one third. The rest is just stories which you can agree with, disagree with. I would say to you, look at that one third, it looks at what are the deliverables that we as a country is paying for, that the department has said they're going to deliver on. It's in there. You don't have to worry about this, how the objectives were written, how the strategic plan was written. Just look at the deliverables. And on the deliverables, you can then ask the question, how does this contribute to economic growth, to unemployment, to employment, to dealing with the issue of poverty, to dealing with issues of inequality. That's where you ask. And I can guarantee you now, to this, 50% of that stuff will not speak to what you ask. Which then means that it's the role of Parliament, the role of this committee, to change the storyline. Because it's not about oversight for the sake of oversight, it's also about giving new directions. I think this committee has got a golden opportunity to do that. But it also has the opportunity to look at the reports from the Committee of Public Accounts, and again I'm saying content advisors and researchers need to bring some of these things together. I don't know how they operate in the administration. Maybe young men and women are sitting together and they talk to each other. I know where I work, researchers don't question each other until I said, you can't be listening, hear somebody talking hogwash or cot wallop and you not saying anything, because the system is about knowledge production, and those groups of people need to create knowledge and information for you to do your work better. I think I wanna just say one point on this next slide on assessment, which is basically slide 17. There is a need to look at civil society input, and I think there is sometimes just to look at those that's involved in the tripartite alliance, which is a good thing, but I think you need to look outside that too, because my own view, the dealing with only with COSATU coming here and civics coming here, civic associations. It's the same old. That's why I suggest people like Chris Molodeki and others to come and talk to you. You need to hear those things that others don't want to hear. That's the point I'm making. On the economy and social policy and other areas. Even on the financing. Because there's no debate around the financial institutions. We need to have it to the point where we agree as to where we stand. We think there's an insufficient use of Section 32 reports. Section 32 reports are those reports which I would say to you, if you have agreed what your priorities are, which means which are those functional areas, then I would ask you that you consider asking your researchers and advisors to dig into Section 32 reports. Because Section 32 reports give you the spending trends of each and every department, of each and every agency in government. And if you read those Section 32 reports, you will become aware, at least by the end of December, where fiscal dumping is going to happen. So don't let it be a post facto issue. Catch the thing before it becomes a fiscal dumping matter. And the December report, especially the December report, well, because you can't spend R1 billion within 3 months. It's impossible.
Yeah.
Or R100 million in 3 months if it's not social grants. Sorry, if it's not social grants. You can't spend that. And that December report, I would say to you, ask your, direct your team to get that report on those key functional areas, and you'll see where the fiscal dumping is going to happen. So there's also the thing that I think needs to be asked much more in terms of numbers and follow through. Where are there going to be savings? Where have you prioritized? And what are the efficiency gains here? Now, we talk here about effective. Effective's got to do with impact. But there can be a preliminary assessment what the effect on the B of the spending. But efficiency has got to do with value for money. How can you guys do things differently and still save the country money? And we think that that's a key question to be asked. Che, I would ask Shane to quickly take you to the last two slides because my eyes can't see these things, which is slide 23, 22 and 23, and then we will conclude.
Just with all of that backdrop, essentially these final two slides really, and earlier honourable member you asked about how these actual instruments and apparatus of fiscal and financial measurement tools can be applied. And so this on 22, just as a real demonstration and also to see how the money flow and shift is in accordance, whether in accordance or not, to the policy positions of the government, and thereby achieving the oversight effect of the executive arm in financial expression as well as in the policy. This here I have for you the table. So just quick description of how to read this. This is essentially our national fiscal framework, the entire thing, okay? And the 2018 MTEF and the 2019 MTEF are the last year's budget, okay, for the 19-20 financial year, this financial year, versus how we plan for this financial year, the 2019 MTEF for this financial year. So essentially, the difference in between, that is all where all the color bars and stuff, the cells come in, is how the money shifted. So if you go through all this line by line, you really start to really think, earlier, Professor Plaggy Chairperson asked about every single, what information needs to take the broad view as well as go 3 feet deep. And this is what we're doing line by line, right? So number one, the minus 1.6 billion, that is only to the national departments. Okay, so what we see here, comparing last year to this year, the shift has been that the money has been pulled out of the national vote, the department, and then some money, 489 million, added to the some of the sort of direct charges, like the judges' fees and members and presidents' fees and so on, salaries. And then you see suddenly this huge drop in the provisional allocation for contingencies. Now this minus 2.298 billion. That money, one immediately should then go into asking, well, first, where was this money, and then where is it going, right? And where it came from is actually, if you look previous year to last year's budget, these are actually some of the monies centralized from provincial and local streams, mostly provincial. Remember, there was that huge re-centralization of the provincial in the division of the provincial resources in the division of revenue bill. And so if you read that and going on, you go to the final line, which is plus 26 billion at the bottom. Essentially that is showing that there has been, despite all the speak by the executive arm about consolidation, there is actually a fiscal expansion, meaning that more money will be spent. Okay? Over and above, this has to be over and above the inflation adjusted. Why? Because it is already the NTEF, which is already inflation adjusted figures. It is actually increased, yes.
Real
increase. Correct. Yeah. And what that then speaks to is, now one last, out of the 26 billion, where the most chunk, the biggest chunk of that money went to? And then you go up, you quickly see provisional allocation for ESCOM restructuring, the 23 billion, of course, okay? And that, you then should go and think about, well, remember, there is quickly following that was the special appropriation, which Financial Fiscal Commission will be here to brief the members on that on the 3rd of September. And all of that needs to be sort of all come together in answering that question of the special appropriation into and providing oversight of that process. Some other interesting sort of shifts and movements around what has happened to our national fiscal framework is, for example, I can quickly pull the second last line, compensation of employees and other baseline adjustment, that is the early retirement as well as the, some of the savings that the government has tried to implement. However, whether that actually come into savings, by the way, the reason why you see negative 4.8 billion is because it means a reduction in what you will expect, what you will spend, so that becomes a saving. So it's a soft number, if you will, that that savings of 4.8 billion. And so this is just to demonstrate to the members. Sometimes when you receive information, because and also I've seen, or we have come here to see the information provided by National Treasury to present to the members. And earlier we even speak of sometimes the information comes to you at such a pace and also sort of. I think numerically messy fashion, really the details sort of skip, okay? And so that is, and I'm happy to leave it there, and then if the members have more questions. Yes. Oh, sorry, the second last line, Honorable Chair, the compensation of employees and other baseline adjustments.
Yeah.
That was sort of envisaged the savings that is supposed to come through early retirement plan, the reduction in the civil service envelope. That's still a soft number. Remember, here we're still just looking at budget to budget, how the money shifted. Okay, but we welcome this.
How will we perform before when it comes to the budget?
Very unsuccessfully, I'm afraid. So again, it's all of those considerations and information flow must come into this table, which I hope as advocacy we provide that the tools and the tools of trade to the community.
Yeah, please, can you, because these are budgetary figures.
Yeah.
We should also be informed by what has happened before. For instance, if there's a 4 billion rand that we are already forecasting, right? We'll have to know what are they going to do differently. Because if we have never hit the budget before, why must people use now and so on?
Yes.
So I'm just saying that the historical number also plays an important to
absolutely
to educate us.
Absolutely. Yes. Okay. Can I come back to the slide later? The next slide on the slide 23. Now this is where as the Financial Fiscal Commission we try to bring slightly more face to this fiscal and financial oversight. What I have for you before you, Honourable Chair members, is the figures for provincial cash reserve at year end, that is financial year end, where everything should be cleared out, money paid, so on, right? The book is closed. As a share of the main budget, of the provincial main budget, okay, and this is, I need to emphasize, cash sitting in the exchequer accounts of provincial treasury, okay, for the province. And there is, first, right off the bat, we have to admit, and earlier Honorable Chair spoke about inequality, the leaking buckets, and also what the principal agent's problem between the executive, right, so the minister, the MECs of the provinces, and the DGs that are the administrators of the and CEOs of the OM, and the essentially here what we see here, there is a huge inequality, right? I believe born in information asymmetry. Okay, because some of these MECs, they probably might not even know of these figures. But for example, and also between provinces, right? Here is, for example, Eastern Cape, they have roughly 12% of their budget in terms of cash numbers in their bank accounts. Also Western Cape, Gauteng. So we see there is a sort of inequality between provinces in terms of their cash liquidity sort of at the year end as flowing money kept for the new financial year before that starts.
Is that good or bad?
I think, and this is a very good question, knowledge and tough one, because immediately the DGs will say, or the DDGs of Treasury will tell you that we need to keep some liquidity buffer within the Treasury in case the province suddenly needs a huge adjustment, or they will say that these are savings for some infrastructure bill or special project that will allow you to do enable you to do. However, sometimes it does come in the form of inefficiency, right? And also, in the sense, and this is where all the intergovernmental relations and also the constitution should come into play is. Remember that provinces, they are in the main social services driven, right? It's health, education. The money kept here should have gone to the people, right? To deliver on those social services and not to keep or make a profit out of all of those activities. And so this is extremely tricky. And not only that, excessive cash reserve strikes a question mark in terms of how efficient and effective is your provincial government working. But also, if we look at, for example, Eastern Cape, a province that has always, for a long time, complained about backlogs, and it certainly has backlogs, why should it have this amount of 12%, right, of its budget sitting in the bank? One could argue Gauteng and Western Cape, because they have more own revenue generating powers, and that's how they accumulated their surplus. But let's look at, say, for example, Free State and Northern Cape. They are really holding, the budget by a thin thread. So So this is really, in my view, and I hope as a gateway for the committee over on the provisions, is to really see that there are these sort of off the budget and off the, and I don't think that these are often measured sort of frequently enough in monitoring how the budget became real money and money to services in the province. And then a quick challenge. Sorry.
Just I think on this one, or remember, let's park this one. Because this like depends a lot of things and perhaps we need to engage National Treasury with this. Because it may be talking on a number of things. We speak about the 30 days payment of small businesses and so on, which may not be happening. We're speaking about municipalities where provincial governments are not paying municipalities and so on and yet. So you may find that there's some correlation in those things and so on. But and I think if we could just pack it and let's remember when we deal with the National Treasury so that they can spend this thing. And we, government operates on a cash budget basis,
yeah.
Right? So it's not a question that you want to have a lot of cash. You're not going to declare dividends to anybody at the end of the financial year.
And then a quick challenge.
Also, Matt, what we can do is to write out a full story for you on the two slides. So we'll ask Shane to work on it and so that he gets you something by Monday next.
Okay. A quick challenge, because I mean, this being a workshop as well as the information the FSC really presented before you. You know, sort of cross-sectional in a way. That means cross across, and then for only say year 17-18 financial year. The quick challenge to this is, well, that's only for that year. Maybe it's the 30-day and award the. Maybe it's only for, you know, it's a once-off incident or event. Then that's what I have for you. The next slide. Slide 24. Over time, these are the trends in those cash balances over.
Yeah, just add again. You only presented in percentage forms. Can you tell us how many billions are those?
Yes. That will be on which on slide 24. I'm sorry. I structured this in somewhat more as the chairperson, if you allow me, the sort of workshop format, you know. So I'm also kind of leading the material I present. So that would be on slide 24. Those are the actual absolute numbers. Same measuring parameters, standard of measure, which is the cash balances at financial year end, and those are the over time from 2013 to 2018. Okay, and as we can see, that divergence which we saw on or inequality, if you were the previous, on the previous slide, is a build-up over a few years, right? Gauteng, Eastern Cape, Western Cape, in particular, their cash balances at the financial year and went up, right? And in this slide, then one, would ask then the question, or and we advise the committee, honourable chair members, to ask the question is, what happened during those years that this money kept accumulating, this cash reserve kept accumulating? For example, we heard about in Gauteng, the Lady City Mani tragedy, and that was squarely blamed on not enough money.
Yeah.
And yet we see here that there has been that continuous build-up. So it's these type of the what earlier said the right questions and not even, you know, a fearless, you know, question put to the executive when they come here, we ask them to be here to account, that will willing to assist you in those in that regard. Okay, so given the time pressure, I now shall stop right there and hand back to the chair.
Chairperson, just
2 minutes, Prof.
Yeah. I forgot to respond to Honorable Sarupeng's point about illegal stuff. Nothing has been done illegally. It's the choices that get made and how the choices get made and what set of information informs the choice made. And our parliament and committees need to interrogate that. Chair, I just thought that for members that might not know, that there are four first calls in the budget before it gets tabled. The one is our debt repayment, then it's the payment to the judges, then it's parliament, and then social grants. When that is cut, then we start talking about the budget. So I thought that's an important point to make. Then the last point is that where is this thing now? So it's going upside down.
While you're looking at that, can I allow Honourable Minister to?
Thank you, Chairperson, and once more, my apologies for the late arrival. I just wanted to find out, in other countries, like Honourable Kwakwa has indicated, and in particular, probably in the US, this type of committee is seen as the most powerful of all committees, and its members is supposed to be the most influential. In your experience over the years, have you seen a semblance of that in this type of relationship between this committee and other committees and the work that this committee has done over the years? Just for interest's sake, your experience. This was brought on by your masterful.
I think you're right. No, did I see it? No, I haven't seen it. And then, you see, you can either stand in the way of history making, or making sure that this committee gets remembered in terms of its historic legacy relative to other committees. I'm not looking for rent from you at all. I'm not doing rent seeking. But this committee and the finance committee are the two, in our assessment, the two most powerful committees in parliament. Because you deal with economics, you deal with social policy matters, you deal with administration, and you deal with real accountability. So of the committee can approve a particular policy, but if that policy doesn't get passed, it appears before you through appropriation, and that doesn't really matter. So the point that I was making earlier, it's always useful to have this interflow between committees. So when a committee sees a thing, it shouldn't be a problem for you to say, hey, but make sure that when you approve that policy, it actually costs us net because we don't have fiscal space. What we used to do, I mean, this is the trickier thing that we used to do when I was in administration. I won't say the ball. One day somebody brought to the table about in parliament, at the department. And I looked at the board was this thing, and I said, give it to us. I go to my office in the treasury, and this bill is going to cost us 50 billion rands. And they got a fright. Now, I haven't costed the bill. I just paid through it, I guess, and make a guess to it. Now, surely I could be totally wrong. In fact, I was totally wrong. But I got such a fright that by me giving them the signal of costing and pricing, suggested to them I'm going to raise up towards Parliament, towards Cabinet, that this bill is not being costed. So you have an important strategic moment to influence the reorganization of it. To influence prudent spending, but also to make sure that the priorities fit with the points the chair raised about poverty, inequality, employment, economic growth. You got a great opportunity to do that. This policy, which is called the MBPRMA. That's
all right.
gives you substantive authority. But the question is, how do you, how, you, I don't want, I'm not suggesting create chaos, because that would be wrong. But it creates you, it gives you the opportunity to start making sure that the administration, when they appear before you, knows that you should be counted. No reflection on the past. But when they appeared before Comrade Bupalezi and the Ministers Committee, the department was shit scared. Sorry. At the Finance Committee, they were scared. Because questions will be asked. Things will be turned upside down. When in reality, it's also supposed to happen in the Appropriations Committee. And I'm suggesting to you, if you step up to that plate about what the Appropriations Committee is all about, then you can deal with oversight in the capital. But if you're going to allow it to go through as, ah, it just needs to happen,
Chaperson, if you look at process slide 11, where you are speaking about increasing visibility with a retreat site business, in particular with the big infrastructure, I made a point there, say the balance between this committee and the portfolio committee itself, and when you made the example of the Mawudia Pokum or whatever, where the MMs not want the committee from the province to have oversight or the site visit, and the indications of unannounced and all those type of things. I think the reality is that we do have the power, but how to exercise that power is a bit challenging, and there needs to be clear a differentiation on when can you and what needs to be done. And I think these are some of the challenges that one would have. Chaperson, just from an interest rate, during the period of recess, I did a introspection or a reflection, and I realized that it was good for me to be in this committee after the opportunities that I have had. And I put it away for another time.
I work in a national treasury for 9-10 years. What we call the golden years, you know? The golden judges and the golden treasury. It was the period when we put things together. That's the golden part of it. What's the part of it? During the period, there's never ever been to date, I think, I might be wrong today, Darren and others can say whether it's right or wrong, a visit of the Appropriation Committee or the Finance Committee to the National Treasury. Never ever been. And the unit I was working in was called the Public Finance Unit. We deal with everything, us and the budget. We used to call ourselves, we're disciples of God, you know, because we're managing the money that God has given us for the public. Nobody has come to the church to ask, how did you get to those decisions? Why have you made those decisions? You only use Parliament as a way of doing, asking those questions, and you don't even have enough time to do it. Which brings me to your program. Your program says that you're asking the mandate of the treasury, then you're asking the mandate of the public finance unit, you're asking the mandate of the office of the public, office of the chief procurement officer. The other two don't have mandates, man. There's only one mandate the less, that's what treasury mandate. The other two, you need to look at what is the responsibility of those units, because they don't have a mandate. The mandate sits in the treasury as the mandate, and the head of treasury is not the director general. Chapter 2 of the PMFA says the head of treasury is the minister of finance. The head of treasury is appointed in terms of the Public Service Act. It's the accounting officer for the treasury budget. and the head of Treasury, the Minister of Finance.
Uh-huh.
That's why previous ministers, they don't understand why you don't ask them the hard questions from his own party, if you allow the opposition to ask the questions. But my point would be, why don't all of you ask the hard questions? We're confusing these things because the system has allowed us to think in a particular way. But the PFMA is clear who's the head of Treasury. And I'm just suggesting to you, the others have got roles and responsibilities, the mandate that's in the Treasury. Otherwise you're confusing the regulatory framework as to how things work. There's the legislation that's establishing the National Treasury, which gives the legal mandate. All the others fulfill delegated responsibilities inside the Treasury based on that mandate. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you so much. Very, very interesting. We'll continue having these bites because there should be a process for us. And the questions that honourable members were raising, honourable Koman, I could see you were itching to say something. Just pack it, and next time you're the first one to speak. When Professor Plutkis is the former head and director of the School of Governance. You can see that sometimes he really wants, he wishes that he can get us into a class of governance and then after that give us percentages and so on. We'll deny him that pleasure. We're not going to give him that pleasure to mark us. But thank you so much, Prof. Zen. Colleagues, members, thank you so much. I think we've got quite a provision to deal with, and obviously let's also deal with this Bible, the PFMA, because I also take a view that in this country we've got this tendency of thinking that everything is a real Bible. The PFMA was drafted at a particular time and so on. And again, we need to revisit these things and say, do they still serve the purpose? If they do, say yes, they do. If they don't, but of course, this thing, once you touch anything in this country, you get all types of labels. And I think what the prophet is saying, let's not be scared to raise this thing because we know what our objectives are. So we look at all this. Do they still serve the purpose? What needs to be done? And we do those things without any fear or favor. Thank you very much. I think the next thing you know that...
Now you know why sometimes people were referring in the past to the Minister of Finance as the Premier.
Yeah. Honourable Kwan, and you were warned. but thank you very much. We have got a meeting with the. With COP at 1:30, that's why we're cutting your prof. And what's the venue? V475 at 1:30. Thank you very much.
Have you been there for me? Now, I just said, I'm not going to be able to do that. Yeah, I'm